This week in Radical History for the week starting November 10th. We start out this week with a Howard Zinn quote. There is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in Radical History for November 10th, 1887, Louis Ling, one of the eight men accused of the bombing at the notorious Haymarket Riot, he is found guilty on very weak evidence and Long, with four others, sentenced to be hung. Lang, however, had a dynamite cap smuggled into a cell in the state and detonated in his mouth, cheating the state out of its glory. All the anarchists, by the way, were posthumously pardoned. At the trial, Louis addressed the court in this way. I despise you. I despise your order, your laws, your forced propped authority. Hang me for it. Also November 10th, the Wilmington Insurrection of 1898 occurred. Originally labeled a race riot, it is now also termed a coup. This incident is the only instance of a municipal government being overthrown in U.S. history. The Wilmington Insurrection was the illegal seizure of power from an elected government of black office holders by white supremacists, who used, among many other weapons, including Gatling gun, to kill off black office holders and install their all-white members to government. Also on this date, in 1910, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman sets out to organize public protest in response to the pending execution of Japanese anarchist Tsuchiya Kotoku, who translates anarchist writings into Japanese and is executed for it. In 1950, U.S. Air Force B-50 bomber carrying an H-bomb develops engine trouble over Canada. The Air Force crew members detonate the bomb with the plutonium core removed, scattering 45 kilograms of highly enriched radium into the atmosphere over Quebec. In 1973, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5 is labeled a tool of the devil by school board, and a teacher who signed it for reading is fired. Slaughterhouse 5 is a commonly censored book because it's realistic. American soldiers behave as soldiers. They talk and swear and curse like men do, and its language often irreverent, including one of my most favorite quotes from this book. Quote, "The gun made a ripping sound like an opening of a zipper on the fly of God Almighty." Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5, banned by many school boards across the United States.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitchagumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early.
On November 10th, 1975, ore ship Edmund Fitzgerald and its crew of 29 is lost in the storms in Lake Superior. No, it's not very radical, but I wanted to insert the song here because I like it. Here's a little more of that song.
Well seasoned. Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the words turn the minutes to hours? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep and took water. And all that remains is the faces and the names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. Lake Huron rolls, Superior sings in the rooms of her ice water mansion. Old Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. The iron boats go as the mariners all go. The gales of November remembered. Mm-hmm.
In a musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gets up the dead when the gales of November come early.
How come Andrew gets to get up?
That's right.
If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy.
You long-faced, overdressed anarchist.
You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy, brother.
Anarchy in the UK!
Anarchy in the UK, anarchy all over the world. In remembrance of the Haymarket Martyrs today, November 11th is International Anarchy Day. So go out and give your favorite anarchist a big old kiss, will you?
Yeah, what you're describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist.
So also on November 11th, 1831, American Slave Rebellion leader Nat Turner hanged in Jerusalem, Virginia. Nat Turner, leader of the Bloody Slave Revolt 3 months before, a slave and educated minister, believed himself chosen by God to lead his people out of slavery. Some of his actions were controversial for indiscriminate killing of whites. However, not to be outdone by the uppity slaves, the white military comes into town and hangs about 60 slaves, most of whom had nothing to do with the uprising. And again, on November 11th, 1887, the Haymarket Martyrs, August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fischer, and George Engel, all anarchists, executed in Chicago. A fifth, 23-year-old Louis Lang, killed himself in the prison cell the night before, cheating the state executioners. Prosecutors never found evidence that they threw bombs, and the so-called police chief fabricated evidence in the trial of the Haymarket Massacre defendants. 250,000 people lined Chicago streets during the Parsons funeral alone. The execution elicited international outcry. All the Haymarket Martyrs would eventually be posthumously pardoned as the truth of the police lies become more and more evident. Also on November 11, 1918, the war to end all wars ends without an end to wars, with 8.5 million dead, 21 million wounded, 7.5 million prisoners and missing, plus a worldwide influenza epidemic killing another 22 million by 1920. As we heard from the movie MASH, war never ends, they just take it on the road. From the short poem called The Little Song of the Maimed by Benjamin Perret, about a town in France where the largest casualties of the war occurred, and is also a place of my birth, Verdun, France. Lend me your arm to replace my leg. The rats ate it for me at Verdun. At Verdun. I ate a lot of rats, but they didn't give me back my leg. And that's why they've given me the Croix de Guerre, the Cross of War, and a wooden leg. And a wooden leg. More World War I veteran news in 1919. Wesley Everest, after serving in World War I, became a lumberjack and a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. During the celebration of Armistice Day in 1919, members of the American Legions attacked the IWW Union Hall. The result was a fight that resulted in the death of four men, two of whom were killed by Everest. Wesley Everest uttered the words during the hall defense, "I fought for democracy in France, and I'm going to fight for it here. The first man that comes in this hall, why, he's going to get it." Everest was arrested and held in jail. During the evening of November 11th, a mob stormed the jail, castrated and tortured Everest. No one was ever charged for this crime, proving once again the value veterans have in this country once they are all used up.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
More American-born and bred haters. In 1978, gay San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone are assassinated by ex-supervisor Republican politician Dan White. White is later convicted of the lightest charge possible in the infamous Twinkie defense. A defense argued that White was depressed because of overconsumption of junk food, and he gets only 7 years in jail for killing two people. He would get out in 5 years after good behavior and less Twinkies, of course.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Right now, there's a movie out about the first gay San Francisco mayor called Milk, starring Sean Penn. This week in Radical History for November 12, 1788, Mexican governor recommends that Navajo establish themselves in permanent villages in the South. 75 years later, under U.S. jurisdiction, the U.S. terrorist army begins to burn those villages. Also November 12, 1920, President of Haiti, unhappy with the U.S. administration, appointed after President Wilson sent in the Marines to Haiti in 1915 to protect American interests, asked for a congressional investigation into the poor state of U.S.-controlled government. Haiti, at one time one of the wealthiest Central American states, is to this day devastated by U.S. colonial interventions. Lastly, for November 12, 1984, a plowshares protest targets silos with pruning hooks, a Minuteman nuclear missile silo in Knob Moister, Missouri. After using a jackhammer and air compressor to damage the silo lid, protesters Carl and Paul Cabat, Larry Cloud Morgan, and Helen Woodson leave behind the Bible, a Native American indictment of U.S. government. From the Book of Isaiah, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." This week in Radical History for November 13, 1921, the Supreme Court ruling definitely prohibits Japanese from becoming naturalized citizens on the basis of race. This ban lasts until 1952. The decision says members of certain ethnic groups are not entitled to naturalization citizenships since they are clearly not Caucasian.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Two more items from November 13, 1969, in New York. Bombs have exploded over the past several days at the RCA building, Rockefeller Center, the GM building on Fifth Avenue, the Case Manhattan Plaza, United Fruit Company Pier, the Criminal Court buildings, and Marine Midland Grace Trust Company, and several other federal and corporate buildings to protest government corporate involvement in the Vietnam War. Lastly, in 1974, Karen Silkwood, popularized in the movie Silkwood, is murdered during her investigation of Kerr McKee nuclear power plant in Oklahoma. All her documentation of safety violations somehow disappear.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know.
This week in Radical History for November 14th, sometimes a lot of good comes with a little bit of bad, such as on this date in 1916 when Margaret Sanger is arrested for operating a birth control clinic. It is the movement she helped created would soon be known as Planned Parenthood. However, her advocacy of eugenics, rightfully so, tarnishes her reputation. Also on November 14th, 1930, during this month, 6,000 people a day are selling apples on a street of New York alone. Shivering, ragged apple sellers stand in pitiful wooden crates, beseeching passengers to buy an apple for any amount of money. These people are classified by the Census Bureau as employed. President Hoover would famously say, "Many persons left their jobs for a more profitable one of selling apples."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
نخلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we are featuring Boston University professor Susan Ockram, whose legal work with refugees throughout the world we have followed over the years on This Week in Palestine. We recorded a presentation by Professor Ockram at Boston University, as she focused on the plight of refugees driven out of their villages in 1948 as Israel conducted its ethnic cleansing campaign. Following Susan's presentation, you will hear Amer Toumey, who will tell the compelling story of how the refugees from his historic village of Ikrit, destroyed during the ethnic cleansing, are trying to reclaim their village. Unfortunately, the story of Ikrit is not unique. Over 350 villages were emptied and destroyed during the ethnic cleansing. And while many villagers were driven into refugee camps in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and the West Bank, some remained or returned and are now living in Israel, or as they like to refer to it, 48. But the villagers were not allowed to return to their villages. They live in surrounding communities, but continue to identify with their village of origin. In most villages, the people are not allowed to return, even to visit the village, except for the cemetery. I vividly remember visiting the village of Sephoria outside of Nazareth with a former villager, and we had to stand in the cemetery to view the remains of the village and to hear Sephoria's story. Our host faced arrest if he took us into the former village, now a wooded hillside. Israel's cruelty knows no bounds. As a form of collective punishment, they force these villagers to live on the outskirts or in other towns and villages, rather than let them re-inhabit their village of origin, which means so much to them, and for the most part stands empty to this day. The goal is to make life difficult for Palestinians with the hope that they will leave Israel. But that is definitely not happening. Even after 67 years of exile from their beloved villages, the descendants identify with that particular piece of land. As you will hear, Ikrit's story is a bit different because it was, or is, a Christian village with a church standing at its center. And although the village was destroyed, the church remains and is allowed to function as a Christian church on a limited basis. So villagers from Ikrit, which is in 48, can go into the church as well as the cemetery. Some of the young descendants of Ikrit have decided they will occupy the church. They will actually live there, and they do. It is an amazing story that you will hear from Amer Toumey, a third-generation descendant of those driven from Ikrit in 1948. But first, Professor Susan Ockram sets the table.
What I'm going to do is try to do a very quick presentation here on the background of Ikrit, Bir Im, and really the larger question of dispossession of Palestinians, both internally displaced Palestinians and refugees. I want to give an overview of the land regime that has allowed this to happen, and then focus mostly on the Bir Im case and leave the Ikrit case for the Ikrit folks to, who are here. They, of course, know their situation better than anyone. And so I'm just going to talk about the legal issues. So I want to talk about some of the main legal mechanisms by which Palestinian refugees and displaced persons have been dispossessed of their lands and properties. And I'll give an overview of the land regime that was put in place in Israel to illustrate how the land confiscation machinery continues to dispossess Palestinians today. And I'll use the case of several villages to illustrate civil society efforts at redress. And I'll tell the story of primarily the village of Bir Im, and not the other village, two villages, Ifrit and Arba Subir, but how the people of these villages have used every legal means possible to regain their lands. And then we'll hear from the activists about that continuing today. But I'm going to focus on the efforts that we made at one point to utilize the UN human rights mechanisms. And again, this is just one illustration of the enormity of the struggle by Palestinian refugees against the ongoing dispossession and land confiscation, which I think will be obvious through the story of Kafr Bir Im. So at least 750,000 refugees were displaced as a result of the wars of the conflict of 47-48, and another 400,000 due to the 1967 conflict. And over 300,000 additional Palestinians have been displaced since 1967 as a result of ongoing military occupation, armed conflict, and various international human rights and humanitarian law violations. And this gives you an idea of 1946 percentages, demographics of Palestinians and Jews. So under the 1947 UN partition plan, the Jewish state was allocated 56% of Palestine, though the Jewish population was less than a third of the population, as you saw in that prior slide, and owned no more than 6.7% of the land. As a result of the 48 conflict, the Jewish state gained control of over 78% of Palestine. And the Zionist militias and Israeli army expelled or forced out between 750,000 to 800,000 of the Palestinian population. So shortly after that, the army secured de facto control of the territory, but not de jure, that is legal control, and I'll try to explain that through the rest of the slides. The Israeli government, though, it almost immediately set out to legalize Palestinian dispossession through the use of four main legal mechanisms. And I have those up there. A cluster of laws called the Emergency Regulations, the Absentee Property Law of 1950, Settlement of Title Land Registration Process, and something called the Public Purpose Ordinance. Now, these Israel's emergency regulations have been used to expel Palestinians from their property, to close off their property and surrounding areas under the claim of security reasons. And then the government declares the property abandoned or uncultivated, permitting the state to confiscate it. The emergency regulations use designations of closed areas, security zones, and cultivation of wasteland regulations to requisition Palestinian property. Now, through these measures, 1.2 million dunams of Palestinian land have been confiscated. A series of court cases brought by the Palestinian villagers of Ikrit and Bir Im to regain their lands shows that the government of Israel and the Israeli Supreme Court together have gone to great measures to thwart legal challenges to expropriations based on security concerns that are not valid. And these regulations, of course, have never been used to evacuate Jewish communities or expropriate their property. This is a comparison of land ownership and villages depopulated. This is the village of Kafr Bir Im in pre-1948 Palestine, the sister village to Ikrit. And Kafr Bir Im was a Palestinian Christian village established over 400 years ago. The homes in Kafr Bir Im were built in concentric circles around the hill, with the community church and the school in the center of the village. prior to October 1948, there were over 1,000 people living in Kfar Blikim, and the inhabitants hold deeds for their property today, going back to the time of the Ottomans. The land area of Kfar Blikim is 12,250 dunams, and the village church alone owns 997 dunams of the land, and actually the population and property ownership of pre-48 Kfar Blikim are not contested. This went through the series of court cases, which I'm going to talk about briefly, but these facts are not in contest. So here is a very brief explanation of the struggle of the people of the village of Kfar Blikim to regain their land. And the story started on October 29, 1948, after the hostilities had ceased, the IDF occupied the village, ordered all the villagers to assemble in the community church and surrender their weapons. And the villagers did not resist. On November 13, the IDF ordered all the residents of Kfar Blikim to move across the Lebanese border. Some obeyed, but others refused to leave and stayed in their olive orchards to wait until the IDF would allow them to return. 7 children died that winter, and the villagers tried to return home. By November 20, all of the remaining residents of the village were forced to relocate to the nearby village of Al-Jish, whose inhabitants had already become refugees by that time. Now, between 1949 and 1950, the villagers continued to try to get permission to use their agricultural land and to use the church land. In April 1951, the Israeli government leased the village land and crops to Jewish agricultural companies and hired other Palestinians to work the Kfar Blikim lands. Under the emergency regulations, the military government legalized the extra-legal actions of the Israeli military that evacuated the Palestinians from their homes, and in 1951, Israel destroyed their homes and property well after the armed conflict between Israel and the Arab states was over. Israel then confiscated the land of Kfar Blikim in 1953 and turned it over to Jewish settlements. Now, until today, large areas of the land are used by Jewish settlements for grazing a small number of cattle, and I don't know if that situation has changed. A smaller part of the land is currently used as a nature reserve at a national park maintained by the state and the JNF. And land expropriation under this scheme has had very dire consequences for the village, their descendants, and communities. They lost 12,000 dunams, or 12 square kilometers, of their land, their home, their agricultural homes, their agricultural and grazing lands, and the sole means of their livelihoods. But they also lost an entire community when they were evacuated and their village destroyed. The community of Kfar Blikim maintained an ancient history, identity, and cultural heritage as Palestinian Christians. In May of 1951, the villages of both Ikrit and Birim filed a petition to the Israeli Supreme Court for return of their lands. And surprisingly, the Supreme Court ordered that they had the right to return as long as evacuation orders had not been issued by the military. But the military governor refused to allow the returns. So the villages submitted a second petition to the Supreme Court requesting implementation of the court's first order. And the Supreme Court asked the government of Israel why its order could not be implemented. Then on August 2nd of 1951, the military legal advisor issued a secret memo to the military to issue evacuation orders, obviously in violation of the Supreme Court decision. And in 1953, the government of Israel ordered the village land confiscated under the land acquisition law and then claimed that Birim was abandoned land. And in September of 1953, the IDF dynamited and bombed the homes of Kfar Blikim. In 1966, the Israeli military rule ended, but the villagers were not permitted to return. And from 1966 onwards, the Birim villagers have filed petitions to the Israeli president, the prime minister, members of parliament, and other public officials seeking return to their lands to no avail. In 2003, the Israeli Supreme Court reversed its previous decision permitting the return of the villages, of the two villages, of Ikrit and Bir'im, on the grounds that this would be a legal precedent for the millions of Palestinian refugees seeking return, and that that needed to be decided in political negotiations, not through the courts, as the case of Svit versus Israel. So today, the former residents of Kfar Bir'im and their descendants number about 2,500 people. They're internally displaced in Israel and refugees in Lebanon and elsewhere. Many of the villagers and their descendants live in the homes of other abandoned property of refugees. And when the former villagers and their descendants try to go to the village to worship on various occasions, including to bury their dead, they pass a sign claiming that the site was an ancient Jewish village. Okay. So another important law is the 1950 Israeli Comprehensive Absentees Property Law. And under this law, any person leaving his residence for any length of time after November 29, 1947, and going to an area that was held by enemy forces or armies that fought to prevent the establishment of the State of Israel are deemed absentee, and that's a legal term, and their property is then subject to confiscation by the custodian of absentee property. Present absentees are people who were also dispossessed of their land, and they are deemed to have left even though they have remained on the property throughout the conflict. And this designation was a fiction to evict Palestinians, and the absentee property legislation has resulted in another 4 to 5 million dunams of Palestinian land being confiscated within Israel and transferred to the Israeli Development Authority. So I'm not going to say much about land holdings, how they were held, except to say that because of the legal nature of Palestinian land holdings under Ottoman time, most Palestinian Arabs had not registered individual title to their lands before 1948, so only about one-third of Palestine had been registered by the British during the mandate period. Now, in the case of... this is Bedouin land of the village of Shibli. I'm not going to say much more, except that the Bedouins, because they had communal land holdings, have been particularly vulnerable to dispossession. They don't have individual title. And this is another case, the Araba Subiye village, Bedouin village. I won't say much more about it. But they went from owning and using over 18,000 dunams of land to today, where their land is actually completely confiscated. Okay. So the next land scheme I just want to briefly talk about is the Public Purpose Ordinance. And this allows Israel to take lands for certain public purposes. Two legal cases have interpreted the reach of this ordinance in such a way that Palestinians cannot effectively challenge any use of the ordinance to take their lands. In a case called Dweik, the court said that the government of Israel doesn't have to give any reason for confiscating land for public purposes, as long as the Minister of Finance certifies that the land is needed for a public purpose, that's all that's required. And in another case called Bor, the court said that if the government decides to change the purpose of the land taken under this ordinance so that it benefits Jews only, that's a permissible taking. And between 48 and 92, this particular ordinance was used to confiscate another 1.8 million dunams of private Palestinian land. So I think this chart really shows well the change in land ownership. Following the 48 war, Israel was in control of 20,600 square kilometers of land, but the state and private Jewish owners had legal title to no more than 2,900 square kilometers. The state of Israel, through the means of the land regime that I've been describing, expropriated and confiscated some 17,000 square kilometers of land mostly owned by Palestinians. And by 2001, Israel had confiscated almost 89% of the land owned by Palestinians in Israeli territory. So what this chart shows you is that from 1948, when 94% of Palestine was owned or held by Palestinians, while 6% was owned by Jews, until today there's been an almost complete reversal. The land mechanisms have resulted in 93% of the land area of Israel now held or owned ostensibly by the JNF and the State of Israel, and no lands held by these entities can ever be transferred to non-Jews. And I thank my colleague and friend Osama Khalabeh for this slide. Meanwhile, another story in the occupied territories where the legal mechanisms are not exactly the same, but they operate in a very similar manner. 400,000 Palestinians were expelled or displaced by the 67 war, and approximately 20,000 have been displaced every year since 1967. And most of this land confiscation has taken place through a series of military orders issued by Israel's military civil administration, as it calls itself. And many of the NGOs call it the quiet transfer of Palestinians that has resulted in land confiscation taking place through revocation of residency permits, denial of family unification, demolition of homes, deportations and removals, and most recently, the construction of the separation wall. I'm not going to say more about the military orders. You can see the results here. And the abandoned property orders. And I just want to come to you by 67, two-thirds of the land in the West Bank had not been officially registered. So this military order 291 froze the land registration process that had been ongoing under Jordanian rule until that time. And now one-third of the West Bank, over one-third, is now claimed by Israel as state domain. And in 2004, Haaretz published what were previously non-public figures indicating that another 13% of the West Bank was to be designated as state domain land and confiscated from private Palestinian owners. So I want to mention just a couple of things about post-67 events. The Ministerial Committee for Development of the Negev and the Galilee allocated $2 billion for breaking up, and the purpose was breaking up densely populated Palestinian areas. And in 2005, the Shimon Peres plan was a package of benefits for Jews who agreed to move to the Galilee. And many of you have heard about the Gaza disengagement as though it was a movement out of occupation, but part of the plan was relocation of the settlers to the West Bank, but also to Galilee and the Negev, and a compensation bill that was passed by the Knesset, which authorized a bonus of $50,000 to $80,000 for Gaza settlers to settle in the Galilee or the Negev. So very quickly about the wall. Here you can see the route of the wall and the percentage of Palestinian West Bank population affected. I'll just mention some of the major effects. It makes permanent the land confiscation in the West Bank of the last 45 years and brings in major settlement blocks. Palestinians holding Jerusalem IDs are stripped of their right to live in Jerusalem. It restricts the right to work, to education, to health care, and family unity. And it's caused the destruction of homes and property that are going on even as we speak. So with this background, it should be obvious that durable solutions for Palestinians dispossessed of their lands and properties and made refugees must include their rights to return property restitution and compensation. But we're no closer to durable solutions today than I think we were in 1948. and the efforts to redress their rights in the Israeli court system have been essentially futile for Palestinians, as you see from the example we're going to hear from about the Ikrit case. Hundreds of Palestinian land expropriation cases have been appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, and none has been successful. Israel is a party to all the major human rights instruments and international humanitarian law treaties, but it has not ratified any of the international complaint mechanisms that allow remedies through those treaties. The U.S. has, of course, been Israel's protector at the UN and used its veto consistently to block effective action at the Security Council. In addition, there is what we call the protection gap, which is critical treaty provisions and international agency status statutes that omit Palestinians from basic rights guarantees or have been interpreted in such a way to do that. The Kfar Bir'im and the Shibli and Arab Asubiya families have all sought intervention through the international machinery. After all their remedies were exhausted in Israel, the villagers filed a petition in the UN Human Rights Commission in 2005 for return and restitution of their land. And the petition had all the requirements, was accepted by the Commission's Subcommittee on Communications, and then inexplicably was unfiled without explanation. And that is it's unprecedented. We have never heard of it, those of us who've been working in the UN for ages, never heard of such a thing as an unfiling after a filing was accepted. But the petitioners refiled what's called the 1503 petition in 2006, and it was again accepted for review by the new UN Human Rights Council. And then in 2008, the petitioners were told that the Human Rights Council would no longer consider the petition. Again, no explanation was offered. So the villagers of Bir'im, Ikrit, and Shibli have been assisted over all these years by enormous efforts of lawyers, non-governmental organizations, activists, and a very determined coalition of civil society actors. And I think what these efforts have shown us is that despite the very strong legal rights even recognized by the Israeli Supreme Court itself, that these rights of restitution, property restitution, return and compensation, that Palestinians have been unable to access the remedies available to victims of egregious and ongoing human rights violations. So far, painstaking and strategic efforts to use both the Israeli domestic and the global UN mechanisms have been futile in these cases. And the case study, I think, tells us that legal efforts alone will be insufficient to redress Palestinian rights, and that new and strategic ways of using the law, along with grassroots and other activism, must be found. And so with that note, I turn it over.
First of all, I want to thank Dr. Suzanne Akron for her extraordinary presentation. It was amazing. Thank you. Thank you, Shadia, for presenting the case, and of course, Michelle, for organizing this event. First of all, hello. My name is Amir Tomi. I'm from the third generation of the descendants of the village of Ikrit. My grandfather and grandmother were from Ikrit. They were born there until they were exiled in 1948. I wanted to tell you about the things we are doing for the past 3 years in Ikrit, and that we have been presenting to people from the start of our project 3 years ago until now, right here in Boston. So I'm very honored, me, Shadia, and Ella, are very honored to be here and to join you in this event to tell you our story. As Michelle has told you, I'm a student at the University of Haifa. This is my final year. I'm studying political science. And I wanted to tell you my experience about living in the Church of Ikrit. I started my journey with the youth group of Ikrit 3 years ago, as you have seen in the movie. After at the end of the summer camp in 2012, we decided that we wanted to return to the village in order to live there, to experience life in Ikrit before we die and we get buried there in the cemetery. And that's actually what we did. We got together, me and 10 of the guys and the girls from the summer camp, and we decided to just be there. Our main goal was not to leave the village and just to live there under church until something happened. We decided to go on with the struggle from the church, from up there. But of course it wasn't easy. The thing was that we had to get used to the conditions up there, because the village, the hill itself, the church itself is isolated. The closest place we can get food from or we can go to buy some other stuff is an hour away. So we had and we still have a lot of difficulties. The second thing, as you saw, was that the land administration officers always come to the church, to where we live. They always come to take our properties. Their goal is to stop the struggle of the people of Ikrit, and specifically to stop the struggle of the youth of our group up there. So everything that is outside the church and not inside the building of the church, they come and take for us. They took a lot of times. They came. They took our beds. They took our couches, our chairs, everything they see outside. They take it. Even the wood that we use for heating in the winter, because we have difficult winters up there, as you saw the picture of the snow and everything. So. As you can see, we are having a lot of difficulties up there, but you can say that we got used to it because we feel that Ikrit is our home. Even though I was born and raised in Haifa, but I feel that Ikrit is my home and it is the place for me to start my struggle. The struggle starts in Ikrit, as we believe, and it ends there. So the first thing was just to sit in the church, manage our struggle, and to return, inshallah, at the end. And from our experience in the youth conferences where we were educated and where we were raised since we were young, we wanted to get the experience of living in Ikrit into the younger generations. As you know, we grew up in these summer camps, and now we are the ones who teach the struggle of Ikrit, the history of Ikrit, and we try to imagine the return with the small children who come with us. So we have a group of children from the third and fourth generation who we educate, and we try to just get them up to the church so they can see the land that they were destined to be away from, but they were supposed to be living on. So that is one of our goals too. We want to educate people about Ikrit, especially the young. And we also want to get the people of the village back to the village itself. We hold festivals in the church. We hold, we celebrate our holy days up there. We have monthly masses. The thing is that we want the people of the village to rebuild their faith in the case, rebuild their faith in return. So if they come, that was our theory, if they come to Ikrit, they hold their weddings up there. They see as their children grow in the youth conferences, so they can get connected to the land at the end and return with full faith at the end. So, sorry, I'm just a little bit... So, because we are a youth group and we want to do things in our own way, since the last ruling of the court in 51, we decided that we're going to take it to the next level. We're going to go to Ikrit, we're going to plant trees, we're going to get some stuff up there. But the problem is that everything we do, they come and take it, or if we plant trees, which is the simplest thing that connects us to the land, they come and they uproot it. So we want people to know about that, and we want people, the people of the village, and the Arabs, and the Israelis, and the Israeli government to know that we will not give up. We will stay at the village, and we will manage the struggle from up there, because this is the place we want to return to. We felt as a youth group that we do not have time, and we do not want to wait another 67 years to go back to the village to return. So we decided that we're just going to go up there and see what happened. And I hope at the end of it, something will happen, because it has been happening for the last 3 years. We see an increasing number of people coming to the village, even if they are not from the village. And we want more people to come and support us, just like you. So that is what has been going on in Ikrit for the last 3 years. We go to work and to university from Ikrit. We are nearly all students up there. I actually studied for my SATs up there, and now I'm finishing my degree while staying in that church. So that's what I want to tell you, that when you are in that church, you just feel that, you feel the success. You feel that this is the place where you can grow up from and develop at the end, and maybe even help other people. And that's actually what happened. Our youth project was developed in other villages. Dr. Akram talked about the village of Kufr Firam. Actually, it is considered a sister village of Ikrit. And a year after we declared our return to the village, the youth of Kufr Firam declared theirs. So we have been having joint meetings with them. We have been talking with them about the youth conferences and how can we work together. And now after we return to Palestine, I will talk to the instructor of the youth up there, and we will have joint meetings also. Another example of our influence in other villages was that there is a village near Tarshiha called Suhmata, if somebody knows it. And a year after we decided to return, we helped them organize their first summer camp, which was really successful. That was their first time sleeping in the village, staying in the village after 48. So I think this movement is really growing with our help and with your help. And I think we could get to something at the end. So the most important thing is, as I said, was to stay in the village, educate people about the village, and let our movement grow at the end. And at this point comes your part. If you think that you support Ikrit's case and the other Palestinian villages as uprooted villages, we want you to support us. There are forms on that table that we want you, of course, if you like, we want you to fill, because we are trying to organize a circle which is called Friends of Ikrit. And we will be sharing with people like you the news of the struggle and what we are doing. And of course, I will show you our Facebook page. We've been having it for the 3 years since we returned. We post news up there about our staying in the village, about the officers coming and expelling our stuff and everything. So if you would like to follow us and help us with our struggle, we would like you to fill those forms so we could be, so we can stay in touch with them. So this is our struggle. This is the way we are doing it. We're trying new ways by social media. We came here to talk to you guys. And if anybody has any questions about, and also for Shadia, about our struggle, about what we are doing up there, I would be happy to answer it right now.
Can you talk a little bit about what your day is like up there in the church? I mean, you know, I mean, we probably think of a church as you come in, you switch the lights on, and you have a water fountain. So, can you talk about what it's like inside the church when you're living
there?
Have
a sushi bar.
Well, actually, the church is really small. It's not a big church, mm-hmm. and we are. 10 guys and girls living there, so there's not a lot of space for everybody. But actually, you can say that we got used to it. Despite the difficulties and everything, I have my own desk in which I study for my exams today. And you can say that we work in shifts. So if I need to go to work or to university, somebody else comes and replaces me at the church. So there is always somebody there, just in case something happens.
And do you have electricity?
Actually, we have a solar system of electricity because the state hasn't given us permission to have electricity up there. Even though last year we had a court ruling, we won the court, and electricity should come real soon, but we are facing a lot of bureaucracy and difficulties. And I personally think they're doing it on purpose, just so we wouldn't get the electricity at the end. But even though at the end, as our project started, and I said that we didn't need the state, and we don't need a decision from the state to go back to return, so we just return. We are creating our own electricity. We don't need the state. Yeah.
What about water?
We have a water line
from
the cemetery. Yeah. Because the cemetery is still active, so the state acknowledges it, and so we have water there. So we got the water from the cemetery down the hill to the church up there, and it was also a hard project. Yeah. All right. If anybody has some questions also for Shadi about the yeah.
So what's the hardest part for you in living in the church, either like a physical, living in the church or otherwise?
Actually, we always fear for, because we are university students and people who work in factories and stuff, we are always afraid of arrests. So as you have seen in the movie, three of us got arrested last year. So if the officers always come and try to take our properties, at the end they will arrest us because we are still putting properties up there. So even despite our fears, we are just going on with the project because this is the project of our life. I think this is more important than anything that happens to you. Because if you want to live and be happy in life, you got to be in your place, which for us is different. Actually, the existence of the church is the thing that I think kept the community together since they demolished the village. The church plays a big role in that because people come to the monthly masses we hold. We have a priest up there who comes every month and all the holidays. We celebrate the holidays up there. So some people of the village see Ikrit as the church first, and then as a community and as a village. So the church is also the center for our struggle since 48. So, and we don't see it only as a church. We see it as a home for everybody, not just for these 10 guys living there. And, sorry. No, it's okay.
How are your parents?
My parents?
Your parents and the parents of the other people in the church.
I think our parents are proud of us at some point because we are the ones...
On the point.
Because we are the ones who are going on with the struggle. We started this, and this started a big movement, which is going on and on. So even despite the fears... And the fear that we may get arrested or our future will be ruined because we are arrested, they support us at every aspect.
That was Amer Toume telling a story of the attempts to occupy his historic Palestinian village of Akrit in what is now Israel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
There can be no question that Speer built big, and he certainly impressed the hundreds of thousands of impressionables who attended the week-long September rallies in a state of impressed delirium.
He stage-managed mass mesmerism, mass enchantment, and the central right of the party, in which Hitler brought the blood flag of the Nazi martyrs into contact with all the other flags, in a gesture that has been compared with that of a cattle breeder.
Speer, though, has many devotees, the Speer carriers, the keepers of the toxic flame. Chief among them is one Leon Krier, a man who genuinely believes that Speer is the greatest architect of the 20th century. This is a piffling opinion and would be of absolutely no moment were it not for the fact that Krier is one of the chief architectural advisors to the Prince of Wales.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We follow the money trail. Who made a killing out of the deaths of 3,000 or so New Yorkers on 9/11? part two of my interview from Buenos Aires with British journalist Lawrence DeMello this week. Also, were the 77 suicide bombers trained by British special forces? And were warnings sent to West Yorkshire Police 2 years before the attacks ignored? Also, harrowing stuff. A lot of people don't want to go there, but we hear tonight from Geoffrey Dickens MP. He's the MP who handed the lost VI paedophile dossier to Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton back in the 1980s. We hear from him last night speaking on Australian television at the time. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. We start this week with the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, and Will Stones here from there. Hi, Will. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, the national minimum wage up from to £6.70 an hour from October, and the living wage to be introduced in April. That's £7.20. But I mean, what's the reality? How enforceable is this? And is this really a living wage?
Well, the national minimum wage goes up every October. It's gone up by the usual very small pittance of an amount, £6.70 from £6.50 from the beginning of this month. There's going to be a further hike in April to £7.20. However, that only applies to people over the age of 25. So the new provisions with regards to living wage are not going to apply to people under 25. So if you're aged between 21 and 25, you'll still just get the national minimum wage, I would imagine, of £6.70. Under 21, it goes down until by the time you're about 16, it's only about £3.50. I understand also that the wage for apprentices has gone up to something like £3.30 this month as well, so not a lot.
Aren't these apprentice schemes often being used by companies, though, just simply to employ people that they're not paying the proper wages to?
I have come across cases like that. I've had people phoning me where they say that their employer has them on an apprentice scheme. When you then ask them about, well, OK, well, who's the training provider? What does your apprentice contract say? They say, oh, I haven't got anything like that. I don't go to any provider. The problem that always arises is that when we then advise people, well, hang on a minute, you are entitled to a national minimum wage here, that is not a genuine apprenticeship, we can take it up for you, we can take it further with your employer, then usually it's usually quite a young person, you know, 16 or 17, then says, oh, well, hang on a minute, I don't know if I want to cause any trouble, because I'm actually, you know, it may be that they're working at a garage, they are actually learning something, they want to keep in with the person who's employing them in the hope that they will get a proper job in the future, and so they're kind of a little bit scared off taking any kind of legal action.
That's right. I mean, someone, it may even be paying half what the minimum, being paid half the minimum wage, they're afraid to lose even that job. So the minimum wage, Martin, I'm going to bring you in here, almost starts to mean not a lot.
No, it's a fig leaf, isn't it, for the increasing exploitation of ordinary folk. I mean, real wages haven't risen in this country for a very long time. In the United States of America, by some studies, they haven't risen since 1973. So that's the reality.
Will, what can you do if someone is prepared to take this sort of thing to court? Because the employer is simply going to say, well, if you're going to take me to court, I want nothing more to do with you, thank you very much.
Well, what you can do is to take a claim out in the employment tribunals, and the tools that you have there are actually quite good because they're the kind of things that employers don't want. One of the things that you can do once you've got your claim in to an employment tribunal is to get an order from the tribunal that employer releases their wage records to you to prove exactly what they've been paying you. Now, a lot of particularly small businesses don't particularly want somebody from the Inland Revenue you or a lawyer from Navan and Bristol Law Centre looking over their wage records. And so there is a good chance that you may be able to come to some sort of a settlement agreement with them. That agreement may also obviously include that the employer isn't allowed to talk about your case, which means that you're not going to necessarily be prejudiced by other employers.
Now, I can remember when I was working back in, 1990, 1991, what's that, 25 years ago pretty much, getting paid £10 an hour. That was considered a sort of reasonable amount at the time, and I was in my late 20s, early 30s. Now it seems that the minimum wage is even less. And when we talk about a living wage, is there any actual evidence that you can live on it?
Well, I think the living wage came from possibly what one of the low pay unit actually calculated that was, it's not a living wage, but it's the minimum amount that somebody could possibly be able to live off if they were working a full working week. So it's not strictly speaking a living wage, it's just a minimum wage. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the living wage that the government's now talking about is going to go up to £9 by, I think, 2017, by which, of course, inflation may well mean that it is no longer even commensurable with the living wage as is going to be set next year.
Martin, let's bring you in again here, because the power has shifted. We were mentioning this last week between employer and employee, where the employers seem to be able to get rid of staff very, very much more easily than they used to be able to, and also to pay them way less than even the minimum wage we're hearing there. So what's going on here, and how does this relate to the macroeconomics and the global economy? What's going on?
Well, if you go in the period from 1945 to about 1973, in a capitalist economy with technological change, you expect productivity per worker to rise at a fairly regular rate. The usual rate was to be about 3% a year. Now, the productivity has carried on rising, and what used to happen is through collective bargaining, that productivity increase would then be passed on as increased wages, which is what led to increased living standards for ordinary people from 1945 to 1973. When that was broken, and you can look at the statistics online, the ruling classes, if you like, the bosses, were able to break the power of the trade unions to change the balance of power in the labour market. So productivity continues to rise, although in Britain it's stagnating at the minute, but that doesn't get passed on as wage increases. And that's okay, because that means that profits increase, which therefore increases things like rental values and property prices, which is all good for those who own those things. It's very bad for the people who are working. But of course the solution to that was to give people credit. So you end up with people taking out loans to buy the stuff that they used to be able to buy through their wage increases. And that, of course, can work for a while until you crash. And that's what we're doing now. Ultimately, if you don't pass on productivity increases as wage increases to the workforce, you are basically building a bonfire on which you will be roasted. And that's what's happened.
Will, on to another topic, well, related topic, which is home care workers. Apparently the courts have clarified that they're entitled to national minimum wage, not just for the time that they're actually doing the job, but also travelling between clients and sleeping over. Tell us about that. I mean, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, for example, expect to be paid for going between one place and another just where I'm actually doing the job.
Well, actually, the law in relation to people who are travelling whilst they're working, so perhaps somebody who might be travelling to a meeting or somebody who's travelling to meet a client, for example, has always been the case, particularly with regards to industrial injury legislation. If somebody has an accident in a car when they're driving, you have to have insurance on your car. And that's because the courts have always made it clear that once you're at your place of work, until you are actually on your way home, then you are regarded as in working time. And so care worker who travels to their first client is not in working time, but if they're travelling between clients, they are in working time. When they're travelling home, they're no longer in working time. And all that's happened with the cases that we've seen over the last couple of years, where the courts have consistently said they're entitled to be paid the minimum wage during that travelling time between clients, they're just assessing and applying the law as it always has stood. The same is certainly true with regards to somebody who's sleeping over, for example. it's long been established the case that a security guard, who might not be involved in doing any security work, chasing people off the premises or during the time that they're actually in place overnight, for example, at a warehouse, is in working time because they are being vigilant, then the same is true about somebody who is having to sleep over in a care home, for example, or at somebody's house in the event that somebody may need them during the night. Now, many care agencies have said, oh, no, you can only be paid if you actually wake up and actually do something, if you take a cup of tea to your client. The courts have made it clear, no, that's not the case. If the crucial point is, could you pop out and get a pizza during that time? If the answer is, well, no, hang on a minute, what happens if your client needs you during that time? You can't. You've got to be there. Then you should be paid.
Sounds like a reasonably good principle. Also, well, it's been looming for a few years now. It's had a few problems on the way, but Universal Credit apparently is going to be coming to Bristol. Is that right? Has there been a trial recently? Universal Credit being this kind of lumping all the benefits into one.
I think there have been trials and tribulations and all sorts of problems in the areas where the pilot scheme has been rolled out across the country, but it is coming to Bristol next week. Not over the whole of Bristol, but certain parts of Bristol. I know Bedminster is one of them. What that means is that people who are currently on a range of benefits, they may be getting some income support, some housing benefit, they may be getting some child tax credit, they may be getting some working tax credit, those are all going to be put into one benefit, which is called Universal Credit. People will, as I understand it, have some sort of protection to ensure that they don't actually lose out, but what welfare benefits and rights advisors are concerned about is the fact that that universal credit will be capped. So each person will have a particular amount of universal credit that can't be increased. So if they have more children or if their needs become more, that won't be able to be increased. It's just a set amount that everybody will get.
You can understand Osborne's got to cap it somewhere, hasn't he?
Well, it seems that he's doing more than that because he's already taking away some of it. We're not really sure what's going to happen at the moment, but the recent furore in the House of Lords about tax credits, that those tax credits are going to be part of the universal credit. So if he's taking them away, he's already going to be reducing somebody's benefit below the amount that the government says they need to live on as a minimum amount. So it doesn't really make any sense. It's quite confusing. And, of course, people always have unplanned for needs, and you need to have a system that's flexible to cope with those needs. I mean, back in the old days, you may remember supplementary benefit, which came in before income support. That those have always been described as safety net benefits. In other words, they're there to catch people to ensure that they don't become destitute, and they're set at the minimum amounts that people can live on with regards to their own particular needs. So there are always amounts that you could put on for people's particular needs. That has been withdrawn over the last 20 or so years, and it appears that it's being withdrawn even more, so that many people on universal credit won't even be on a figure that would be commensurate with those safety net levels as they were 20 years ago.
Now, Martin, isn't National Insurance and Social Security supposed to be there to make sure that people don't fall below that destitute level that Will's talking about there?
Well, it is, yes. I mean, it's not an optional add-on either. Having a comprehensive welfare system that prevents people from falling into poverty also protects the economy against shocks. Just think of what's going to happen in Scunthorpe, where all of these people are going to lose their jobs in the steel industry. They're on good wages at the minute. But if they don't have adequate access to benefits and support, then the local economy in Scunthorpe will fall through the floor.
That's right. It's going to have a knock-on effect like a house of cards.
So the point of having a decent welfare state is that you can make changes, like we're going to have to change this, we're going to have to close this industry down. Now, I'm not saying for a minute that they should close the steel industry in Scunthorpe, but if you're going to have a capitalist economy where these kind of things can happen, the welfare system is there to make sure that you can actually do that in an effective way without crashing the local economy. And the same thing is true on a national level. So as they soar away at benefits, they're actually making the country more and more vulnerable to a crash. So when a crash comes, if they've actually squeezed all of these benefits down, they will create a situation where the economy will be less able to cope with a crash than it otherwise might be.
And what about towns like Scunthorpe that have been built around a giant steel plant like there, that most of the economy, even people, things like places that are servicing cars, you know, the food shops, these kinds of things, are all dependent down the food chain, aren't they, from this steel plant. You're ending up, aren't you, with towns, cities that are actually losing their reason to be there. There's no reason for them to be there anymore.
That's why we've probably got to move to... I mean, the basic principle of universal credit, that there should be a basic support for the population, is a good one. But, of course, it's got to be unconditional support. We should move towards a system which has been discussed in places like Denmark, where everybody is guaranteed a citizen's income, and then they can work on top of that or not, as they choose. And that means that you will accept that some people will just live on their citizen's income and they won't want to work, possibly because they've got mental health issues, whatever it may be. And of course, that flexibilises the labour market. At the moment, the problem they've got with the tax credits is that as they, but what they're making is that people will not have any incentive to take extra work if it's all going to be taken off them as they earn them, earn extra money. And even the Adam Smith Institute has criticised Osborne over tax credits on that basis. And ultimately, the way to resolve this is to give everybody a guaranteed income and then allow them to work on top of that. And of course, you could give the same guaranteed income to multimillionaires. They wouldn't even notice.
Yeah,
the amount of money involved is trivial.
And from an administrative point of view, that has actually been shown by various studies to be the cheapest.
Of course it
way
is, because you don't have to assess everybody all the time.
Exactly.
You just say, if you're on the electoral register, I would say if you're on the electoral register and you can show that you've participated in the election, you're a citizen and therefore you should get a citizen's income.
But what if you just don't want to vote? You have to vote.
Well, you have to. This is what I mean. This is how Athenian democracy used to work. You know, if you are a citizen, you're expected to turn up for the meeting. I mean, that's what you'd say to people, and you could educate children in school. You will get a right to live in this country on a minimum level, but you've got to participate in the political process. And that, of course, then creates a constituency of those who will vote for it, which is what happened in Athens. People were given, poorer people were paid to sit on juries and so on. And juries used to have 500, 600 members.
I suppose what you're saying, Martin, here is that actually modern Britain is actually a step back towards barbarism from Athens.
Well, I mean, the point is, as has been made by Will, it's actually cheaper, because what you'd also do is you'd get rid of things like mortgage tax relief, stuff like that. You consolidate all benefits and tax reliefs into one payment, a citizen's income, which then guarantees every. And of course, what it also does is it gives everybody peace of mind. You know you're going to be all right, whatever. And that means people can then plan their lives confidently, knowing that they're not going to be.
Do the government want people to have peace of mind?
No, they don't, because ultimately, of course, what we're talking about is attempting to keep the 19th century balance of power in place in the 21st century. And of course, it doesn't actually work. As I stressed earlier, keeping squeezing wages down ultimately is self-defeating for modern capitalism. You need rising wages and a workforce that's actually capable of enforcing its rights. That's actually an essential part of the system.
So what you are suggesting is an actual massive drop in the number of civil servants to administer a system like this. Surely Osborne and Cameron should go for it without even thinking about it.
Well, I mean, it was originally Milton Friedman who put forward the idea of citizens' income. And of course, what it would lead to is you wouldn't have to have things like job centres, for example. There would be no need for them.
Will, I can't resist but ask you about, I know you're not a criminal lawyer, this headline caught my notice in The Independent again, Nigel Morris, on the 20th of October. More than 100 solicitors' firms are prepared to take the Ministry of Justice to court over the changes. The anger centres on the shake-up of the system under which solicitors are provided to represent people under arrest in police stations and magistrates' courts. The number of contracts is being cut from 1,600, and pay rates for the work are also being cut. But taking the Ministry of Justice to court, solicitors?
I think that's happened before. I think Chris Grayling, the last minister, was taken to court probably more than any other Minister of Justice over various things, whether it was the legal aid cuts or whether it was to do with the changes to criminal legal aid. Now, with regards to the changes to criminal legal aid, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I don't know too much about it, but I know that Michael Gove is causing major problems by constantly backtracking and saying, well, he's not going to bring in these changes, he's going to look at it again, and then he'll do something else. And I think what's happened this time is that he's ruffled too many feathers again, and he may well find himself in court. I mean, at the end of the day, criminal legal aid to ensure that every person who is accused and who is put on trial is allowed to have proper representation to ensure that we can see that the criminal justice system is fair, is transparent and is working, is a right. It's a right that everybody has in this country. And to change it so that you end up with a kind of, I think what somebody was talking about at work with me today, kind of deal or no deal kind of TV type justice, where it's like a lottery, whereas some people will get the best lawyers because they can afford to pay for them, other people will have no lawyers at all and will just be simply dependent on what the mood of the judge or the magistrate or the jury is that day without having proper representation.
The other thing is the criminal court charges. They've come in recently. I don't know what your experience is of those. Again, this is criminal. I think I'm right in magistrates' courts. But it does seem a bit strange that somebody with nothing should be asked to pay the same as somebody with plenty of money when they go to a criminal court. The idea also, apparently, is to try and persuade people to plead guilty rather than not guilty. So tell us a bit about those charges.
Well, yes, these were brought in quite quietly in April of this year, and ever since then have within the magistrates court system particularly been causing all sorts of problems. 50 magistrates across the country have resigned because they think it's wholly unfair. They can't sit there and impose a fine that they know that somebody is not going to be able to afford to pay on top of all the other fines. We've had cases of people who have said that they have pleaded guilty simply because they didn't want to risk having a higher charge. If you plead guilty at first instance, the charge is £150. If you say, well, okay, I'm innocent and I'm going to opt to have a trial by jury in the Crown Court, if the jury don't agree with you, then that charge increases to £1,200. So it's a huge hike, and it is almost like an extra punitive payment on top of what the punishment that somebody would already be given. So a lot of magistrates, a lot of judges are very unhappy about it. It looks as though it probably will be reviewed in some way within the next 6 months, and let's hope that that will go so that that injustice can then stop. Interestingly enough, one of the things Michael Gove came up with this week as an alternative to that would be to lobby a tax on the huge city firms who are making lots of money out of their financial legal services. That strikes me as being very odd, because I don't think the government at the moment would be agreeable to having a charge on private medical services and private hospitals and private GPs to pay for the National Health Service, for instance. But that seems to be the way that Michael Gove is looking at it. Whether he's able to get those law firms on board on that remains to be seen.
Well, just give us an idea of where you are at the Avon Bristol Law Centre and also the sorts of cases that you can help with.
It's Avon and Bristol Law Centre down in Stokes Croft. I myself deal with employment cases and discrimination cases. I'm particularly interested to hear from people, care workers, who want some advice on national minimum wage issues, or anybody else who wants advice on any employment matter, or if they feel they've been discriminated against, we can deal with that. We also have teams dealing with welfare benefits, dealing with immigration, dealing with community care, and dealing with housing. And you can contact us on our reception number, which is 0117 924 8662. Our website is ablc.org.uk.
okay. Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. We have you in here, I think, every 2 or 3 months, don't we? Thanks ever so much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, were the 7/7 bombings, the alleged bombers anyway, trained by British Special Forces? Well, we heard from Fran Anderson a few months ago, actually, I think it was on the 10th anniversary in July this year. You might be able to go back to thisweek.org.uk and find that show. You can listen to it again about this chap who'd worked for the British Special Forces, the SBS, Special Boat Service, Martin McDade, who was training them. But, Martin, there is quite a strange conflagration, wasn't there, going on up in Leeds 2 or 3 years before the London bombings. We're going to hear in a minute from this chap, Martin Gilbertson, who was part of the ICRA bookshop in Leeds, in Beeston. What do you make of the attachment, though, of this chap, Martin McDade, who apparently was taking a couple of the bombers, Khan and Tanweer, I believe, who were also trustees of the ICRA bookshop, over to Cumbria to train them?
Yes, well, he was an ex-Special Boat Squadron guy, and the suspicion has got to be, as in many other cases, that, as we said in the first hour, that Sunni jihadi terrorists have an intimate linkage with Western intelligence services and special forces going back to the 1980s. And therefore, of course, they're then groomed to carry out the attack, which is part of a geopolitical strategy from inside the intelligence services.
Well, we're going to hear now from Channel 4 News report from a couple of years ago, actually, from, I think it was 2011, with the inquest into the 7/7 London bombings. I mean, the inquest itself, Martin, was not correct, was it? Because you only have an inquest for an individual death. This was the death of 52 people. If you have a multiple death, then you would normally have a public inquiry. But also, the inquest sat without a jury.
And of course, there was no actual conviction of anybody because the perpetrators were all supposedly dead. Although, in actual fact, the obvious thing to ask is, well, who put them up to it? And of course, that's where the questions start to get really interesting.
Well, the family members of those that died, but many of them were extremely frustrated because they were then told by Lady Justice Hallett, I believe, who was the coroner for that inquest, that they would not be able to ask any questions of the authorities and the security services at that inquest.
Well, indeed, and it fits a pattern of terrorist atrocities which achieve certain political goals, but in which the evidence suggests that the intelligence services were involved. For example, this bombing in Turkey of the peace march the other day, which killed 100 and some odd people. Most people in Turkey believe that was carried out by elements within the state, and that is a NATO-aligned state, just like we are.
Well, let's have a listen to that Channel 4 news report and the voice of Martin Gilbertson, who was working with Tanweer and Khan, two of the alleged London bombers, in the ICRA bookshop in Beeston, in Leeds, in the years running up to the attacks.
In Beeston, Leeds, anti-war campaigner Martin Gilbertson thought he'd found people of like minds when he started working with a young, opinionated community worker, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, and the other local man who had bombed London, Shehzad Tanweer.
I was shocked, and I wonder why nobody listened to me, the police. But I know that other people were talking to the police at the same time. There was many people voicing their concern about what was happening in Beeston, but nobody would listen to anybody.
Martin Gilbertson fell in with MSK and Tanweer because they were working for council-funded projects in the community. He provided the computer skills.
But working in a Muslim shop introduced me to the Muslim community, and I was quite happy to work with the charities because they were all legitimate funded charities.
Martin Gilbertson was mending computers at the ICRA bookshop, which has now changed hands. The new business has nothing to do with ICRA. He remembers MSK as a normal guy.
It was around about this time I first actually came into contact with Khan. It was not how do you do, Khan. He was in and out of the shop. He was also a helper for them. He would help people with their Learn Direct stuff.
That was the Channel 4 news report from 2011 there. So what do you make of this?
Well, the suggestion is that the guy who was working in the bookshop, and we know for a fact McDade was an ex-Special Boat Squadron activist, not an activist, a member of the Special Boat Squadron, and he was the one who took them off on weekends training and so on. Now, the suspicion is that all of these terrorist actions, going back to the 1980s, have been orchestrated by elements within NATO's intelligence services. So it fits that pattern.
Also, we were mentioning earlier the inquest. I mean, this does seem to be one of the hallmarks of these sorts of attacks. Can you just take us through what you think are the big questions that when there's a news story of some kind of terrorist attack or a large incident like the one we had in Ankara, for example, where would you look to decide is there something rather more to this than meets the eye? Because, you know, what happens is we get loads and loads of news reports, and then when there's contradictions to those news reports that have happened on the day, often maybe days after, even months or weeks after, then those news reports, we never hear them.
Well, the first point I would make is know the context. The context is that we know for a fact that NATO intelligence services have been involved in commissioning acts of terrorism. For example, the Bologna bombing in 1980 in Italy, various fatal attacks in Turkey, the so-called Egonican networks. Now, when the ISIS suicide bomber, if that's what it was, attacked the Suruk demonstration by the Kurdish political party some months ago, that immediately led to the Kurdish armed militia, the PKK, presuming that the state had been involved in that attack, and they said they killed two policemen. They killed two undercover policemen who they believed were responsible for leading to the attack. Now, the fact is, in the rest of the world, where people have a much more wide sources of information than we do, people understand quite well that when a terrorist attack takes place, you can't presume that you know who did it. And we have documentary evidence going back decades which shows that NATO intelligence services, and not just them but them in particular, have engaged in creating terrorist incidents, major terrorist incidents in which scores and hundreds of people have been killed as part of a geopolitical strategy of tensions. They call it strategia di tensione in Italy. Now, in other words, whenever you hear, just don't presume that you know what's happened, because you'll need to look at all the details over time to draw the correct conclusions, even if you're an investigator, never mind just a general member of the public. But the point is, when we suggest that things like this are orchestrated events, there's a track record for that being the case. And you should presume, I mean, basically I do presume, that these events are orchestrated unless there's evidence to the contrary.
Now, that's 7/7 we were talking about there, which was in 2005. We go back 4 years to 2001 now, to the 9/11 attacks, and part two of my interview with Buenos Aires British journalist Lawrence De Mello, who was following the money trail. Who was it that made a killing out of the deaths of over 3,000 New Yorkers on 9/11?
We have to be so careful, Tony. You're a victim of it at the moment. We've got to be really careful, because if we go over certain lines and say certain things that we know, we're classed as crazies, conspiracy theorists, or we are excommunicated from our colleagues in mainstream media, etc. You were mainstream, I was mainstream. Mm. We both of us sort of veered a bit because we feel that's what's right. That's what journalism should be about, is documenting and passing on good information to the public, and also reveal things which we believe are in the public's interest. I focused on, it's not about who did it. You see, this is where the mistake is. So many people sort of say, who is behind 9/11? Let's forget that. Who was behind Diana's murder? Let's forget it. Let's look at what happened. Look at the event. Was this a genuine building collapse? No, right. Who owned the buildings? What was the insurance policies on the buildings? How were they taken out? That's what you need to look at. So you have to look at the coincidences that surround 9/11, and just one of them, which I took an interest, was how Lawrence Silverstein took out within 3 months before the 9/11 insurance for two buildings for attacks and collapse from commercial airlines. Now, how many buildings in the history of modern construction have we had collapse, those sort of sites from airlines? And plus the fact it's New York. I mean, we know all the story about, you know, the jets coming across, and it's an airspace that should be very, very secure. But he took out that insurance. He made a massive amount of money. And here's the interesting thing about the Twin Towers. The Twin Towers, which were constructed late 60s and 70s, they were riddled with asbestos, Tony. Now, we know about asbestos. We know it's a highly toxic compound that causes cancer. You can't use it anymore. And buildings that were filled with asbestos was used as fireproofing originally. And so those tower blocks were absolutely lined with asbestos. So here was the situation. The Twin Towers needed to be modernized for them to justify the rentals for office space because they were a white elephant. They were almost empty. They were losing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars every 6 months. So what did they need to do to encourage people to rent those offices? One, they had to get rid of asbestos. Two, they needed to modernize them. Now, the Port Authority of New York would not permit the demolition of the Twin Towers because of the asbestos content. So that means those towers were not allowed to be demolished, controlled demolition by a construction site to say, okay, we're going to bring these down, we're going to build new buildings. So why would a brilliant developer, Lawrence Silverstein, now if you're a brilliant developer, would you buy a white elephant that has very little occupation? When I'm saying occupation, as in companies occupying space, you're losing money. You're not allowed to develop it because it's full of asbestos. You don't have the permission from the Authority of New York. So why would you do that? And then you invest, you spend your own money because he got investors, but he also invested his own cash to buy the Twin Towers. So what was he planning to do? You invest millions of dollars into a building that is half empty. Actually, I think it was 30%. It cannot be destroyed. Why would you do that? And then you take out insurance that it's going to be hit by commercial aircraft. The insurance policies more than covered the redevelopment of the whole site. I mean, come on. That is such luck, isn't it? I mean, that's why they call him Lucky Larry. So what happens with 9/11? We get perfect footprint collapse into their own footprint, very tidy, very clean, absolutely demolished. I mean, they didn't even hardly have to take anything away because it was all powder, very dangerous powder because people are still dying today from that contamination. And what do? They build up these sparkling, amazing offices that are absolutely booming today. So it was a pretty good deal. Is that a coincidence? Do we have a law of averages? I think it's against the law of averages that you buy a building that is a financial loss, total financial, you invest millions and millions and millions, you take out an insurance policy against aircraft. Within 3 months, aircraft just happen to knock those buildings down and you get billions of dollars in insurance. Pretty cool. So, as I say, I don't want to be, oh, she's a conspiracy nun. I don't care who did it. Well, I do care. But I'm not interested or analysing who did it. All I'm saying is how it happened. And it couldn't have happened how they said it happened. We've got pilots, scientists, you name it. People have said there is no way those buildings came down due to the burning of the fuel or even the impact of those aircraft into that building. Those steel structures did not come down like that. So what do we do? That's all been forgotten, of course. Nobody talks about that today. And if you talk about it, of course, you're crazy or whatever. So, you know, this is why I'm saying we need to go back to 1945 because these things are happening all the time. 9/11, Diana, David Kelly, the Malaysian aircraft, the Boston bombings, all these things happen. We all analyze them. Nothing ever comes out. There's never any truth. So I think to enable us to get a control again of our democracy, we need to go back. We need to stop getting sidetracked with what's going on in here, this country, and Libya and Russia and that doing that. This is all to distract us. We need to go back to the roots and let's look what happened and follow the money and follow the trails and see the individuals that are involved and let's just get rid of them.
Well, that's a fairly succinct summary from Lawrence DeMello there. Of course, the other point I would make is that Building 7 also collapsed, even though a plane didn't crash into it. And coming back to what I was saying earlier, we've got a track record of NATO intelligence services behaving in this kind of way, so that the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has written a book about this, La Repubblica dei Stragi Sani Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, about all the bombings, shootings and assassinations in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. 1980s, and he was the investigating magistrate on many of those cases. So we've got a track record of Western intelligence services engaging in terrorism, as uncovered by the Italian police, and that's the first thing that's going to cross your mind when something like this happens. We know that they blew up Bologna railway station in 1980 and killed 80-odd people. What's the moral difference between that and killing 3,000 people on 9/11? And the answer is not much. And the reality is that that's what we're up against.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Now on to the subject I mentioned at the top of the hour. This is to do with Geoffrey Dickens MP, and I really have to warn people that there's some very disturbing material in this next report. Do tune out or switch off the radio if you feel a bit over or a bit sensitive about this, and also if there's children around possibly. So this is we heard quite a lot, haven't we? And maybe I'll bring you in this on this too, Martin, about this MP Geoffrey Dickens. In the 1980s, he handed a VI paedophile dossier, it's called, to the Conservative Home Secretary at the Daily on Britain, which was then subsequently lost. And then the former civil servant from the Defence, I think it was Ministry of Defence, Peter Wanless, who went on to run the NSPCC, did an inquiry into lost documents like this, and actually didn't find any.
Well, I mean, what I always say in relation to VIP paedophilia is to mention the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, because the allegation there is that MI5 were using the Kinkora Boys' Home as a honey trap. They basically encouraged people to go in there, political targets, to have sex with underage boys, and then blackmailed them. And I think that's really the iceberg underneath all of this. The paedophilia has been used as a means to blackmail members of the political elite to make sure they stay in line, and that's why it's been covered up for so long.
Well, let's go back to the 1980s now to the Channel 9 programme, still running today, in fact. It's called 60 Minutes, the documentary, very much criticised by the VIP paedophile Panorama that came out about 3 weeks ago. And the same programme back in the 1980s spoke to Geoffrey Dickens, MP.
And when I spoke out in the House of Commons in London about this, many of the members of Parliament smirked and jeered behind their hands because they were unwilling to believe that such terrible things could be happening. NSPCC, which is our National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, their inspectors that look after children at risk all over the country, were reporting that throughout the United Kingdom they were finding evidence of satanic abuse. And so that really reaffirmed what I've been telling the House of Commons.
All Satanists have been abused as children. All. I can't imagine any normal person going into something so horrific, vile, disgusting, so violent, humiliating. Could possibly, it's impossible.
Jim Phillips was a doctor of medicine with the police force before he opened his own private practice in Birmingham. Lately, he's more and more focused on victims of abuse in early childhood. He's achieved tremendous results with people who've been regarded hopeless cases within traditional psychotherapy. Perhaps he's most well known for his treatment of patients with multiple personality disorder.
As the children disclosed, I became more and more distressed at what they were telling me, and not a little frightened myself, in fact, because they were telling me things that you only saw in horror films and read in fictitious books.
And so a breakdown in communication, a breakdown in co-working happened in Nottinghamshire. And that became a cause which the nation began to take notice of.
Now, this is back in the 1980s and early 1990s, Martin. There was a lot of talk about this. That was a clip there from the 60 Minutes documentary on the VIP paedophile scandal way back in the 80s and 90s on the Channel 9 programme channel over in Australia. But we're being told, Martin, effectively, that there's really nothing to see here and that the accusations against Leon Britton are baseless.
Well, I don't know whether they're baseless or not, but I think that there's enough evidence for us to investigate thoroughly and to get on top of it. The Kinkora Boys Home scandal has been running for years and has been mentioned for years, and across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland, people know that that's probably what was going on there. And my suspicion is that various other children's homes, like Haute La Garenne in Jersey, for example, and the North Wales children's homes, it's an obvious tactic to use. The De Trou affair in Belgium, where he was allowed to operate for years and years and years, because if you're going to commission terrorist acts, you're going to be quite capable of using paedophilia as a political tool. And I would suggest that that is what's behind all of this. We've got manipulation of elites through the use of paedophilia. Once you've got people dirtied up by showing a video of them having sex with an underage person, then they are going to do as they're told. And that's what the purpose behind it all is.
BCFM.
And now on to have a look at something for a special one for Halloween. We're going to start by having a listen back to the 1990s again to US talk show host William Cooper, where he explains that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was being appointed by Bill Clinton at the time, whose father was actually a member of the SS.
Don't you dare miss tomorrow night or Wednesday night's episode of The Hour of the Time. If you listen closely tonight, and if you listen closely again tomorrow night, you will know why the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the new chairman appointed by Clinton, lied about his father, whom he said was not really a member of the SS. He was conscripted. There's no such thing as a conscripted member of the SS. Ladies and gentlemen, the man is a liar. He's covering up his father's Nazi past and his willing enlistment in the SS, and therefore must be, probably is, one of the ones who have received the heritage passed down from his father. And I don't believe he would be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff if he were not a National Socialist. Remember, what you're learning is there really is nothing new under the sun.
Now, Martin, that's a pretty strong allegations being made there, but there are quite clear connections, aren't there, between the Nazis from the Second World War and the United States security services.
Indeed. I mean, people like Klaus Barbie, who were wanted by the French authorities as the butcher of Lyon, he was he basically escaped to Latin America and then was eventually employed by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques as part of their anti-communist crusade. And I think the evidence suggests that elements of the Reinhard Gehlen, for example, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, ends up as the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Agency. That's not an accident. That's been going on all along. And a lot of the fascist psychological warfare techniques that NATO has adopted over the years are directly related to the kind of things that the Nazis were pioneering in the 30s. And I think that the linkage is actually well established.
Well, Bill Cooper died. He was shot by the FBI just after the September the 11th attacks. But in the few years running up to them, he had a competitor. That was this guy called Alex Jones. And here's Bill Cooper, also another talk show host. I think Bill Cooper was in Arizona and Alex Jones was in Texas. But here is Bill Jones exposing Alex Jones. And Alex Jones is talking about Vladimir Putin as when he was first arriving on the political scene.
Vladimir Putin, who is known as Vladimir the Ruthless, and using all his profanity on national TV, you name it, we won't read the profanity here, but we've got it. This person is on an unbelievable power trip and resembles a demon. He is a creature of the IMF and the World Bank and international communism. He is a former KGB head, and this information is vital, ladies and gentlemen. We are seeing the New World Order really come out in full force. More wars than have been in the last 50 years are going on right now. The war in Chechnya is raging in Grozny with, well, reports of hundreds of thousands dying.
Is that true, folks? Are there more wars going on right now than in the last 50 years? Are there hundreds of thousands of people dying right now in Chechnya? Listen to this. This man is just making it up right out of his head as he goes along.
20,000 to 40,000 civilians trapped in the city. Russian Hinds are being shot down. Tanks are being blown to bits. Massive Grodd unguided rocket attacks are being launched on the city indiscriminately right now. Air and artillery bombardments as well. It's absolutely out of control. It is pandemic, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give you the news first on Y2K. The newest developments, the Pennsylvania nuclear plant has been shut down. One of the main systems transferring the power from it failed, but they say it's not a Y2K problem. And the things I'm experiencing here in Austin, Texas, the shelves are empty.
In a way, Martin, it was a sort of media war between Bill Cooper and Alex Jones there. But, I mean, Bill's pointing out that a lot of the stuff that Alex is saying is just there to frighten people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is when people start to ask questions outside the mainstream, and then when they start to ask those questions, there's all sorts of diversions for them to trip over. I mean, the idea that Putin is a creature of the IMF, I think, is... When he first came to power, I thought he might be, but in actual fact, he has actually disobeyed
but what he's saying
the orders
there,
from the,
I mean,
from the IMF.
It's classic demonisation. He's saying, yeah. He's actually saying Putin is a demon.
Well, exactly. I mean, Alex Jones is a loose cannon. When people criticise the mainstream, they then go to look for alternative views, but those alternative views are themselves potentially part of the manipulation by the intelligence services.
But he's more recently been talking about getting Muslims out of America. He's been, you know, sort of, I think for a long time there was some credibility to what he said, but he seems to have completely lost it.
Yeah, and there are various people are suggesting that he's, various of his people working with him are working quite closely with Israeli intelligence. I don't know. The point is that we should always keep a sceptical frame of mind when we're dealing with reports of anything, whether it's by the mainstream media or by the so-called alternative media. Well, we need to keep our wits about us at all times.
Well, in that programme, Bill Cooper's programme, part of the Hour of the Time, that he was doing there, criticising Alex Jones and critiquing it, he invited people to phone in, and they did.
Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, Phil, good evening. Reason why I'm calling, being I live here in New Jersey, kind of reminds me of something that happened, I guess, what, 40, 50 years ago, when there was a radio broadcast that supposedly we were being invaded from Mars.
Oh, yeah.
In the War of the Worlds.
Uh-huh.
And it pretty much terrorized the metropolitan area here.
It did. What was the name of the city in New Jersey that was featured on that?
Was it Grover's Mill?
Yeah, Grover's Mill. Yeah. All the people in Grover's Mill forgot they even had a water tower. They came out with their guns, and they saw their water tower in the night, in the moonlight, in the starlight, and they thought it was one of the alien tripod machines, and they shot their own city water tower full of holes.
Right. And from just listening to that clip, it just brought me back to remember listening to that show. And it just amazes me that people just don't look out their own window to see what's actually going on.
Yeah, well, I don't think they care.
Yeah.
I think they want something to be going on.
All right.
Think they're waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. I think they're waiting for somebody to whip them up and get their adrenaline going and make fools out of them.
But, you know, some people want that, though.
I know they do.
And they're called
stupid sheeple. How'd you like the way he was whipping up the Christians by calling Putin a demon? Putin is just a human being that happens to live in the Soviet Union and has risen to some position of prominence. We may not like his politics, we may not like his philosophy, but he's just a man like everybody.
Just a man like everybody else. Martin, that broadcast, the radio broadcast, was October the 31st, Halloween 1938. And apparently the nobody connected with the broadcast had any idea it would cause panic. But some people did, didn't they? Harvey Quantrill was involved in the US Psychological Warfare Department.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, basically, people, as any confidence trickster will tell you, people basically want to be deceived. Most of people want to be deceived most of the time that things are all right. And that's how the powers that be get away with an awful lot of stuff. They wouldn't do that sort of thing, would they? But I think the evidence shows that they do these kinds of things, and that they actually spend a lot of time, energy and resources on working out ways to manipulate people. In a totalitarian system, you don't actually have to bother that much with that. Like the Soviet Union didn't have lots of terrorist attacks which were blamed on dissidents, because the dissidents were already very pretty much under the thumb. It's in relatively open societies that the use of psychological warfare takes on its most important aspect. And of course it was exactly this aspect of using modern media techniques plus terrorism which was the modus operandi of the fascists before the Second World War, and of people like Reinhard Gehlen and Klaus Barbie after the war, working closely with MI6 and CIA.
So will you have a happy Halloween? What's the origins of it? Can it come from pagan times?
It's originally at Samhain, which is the Celtic New Year, and it was that when the spirits of the dead were able to communicate with the living. So it is in fact an ancient, a very ancient.
So what's the connection with all the supermarkets? It's everywhere, isn't it?
Well, I mean, what's happened now is it's become commercialised like Christmas, like anything else. But, I mean, it is actually an originally... What was interesting was that the November the 5th gunpowder plot was the Protestant version of Halloween, and that basically is a terrorist false flag attack.
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Cotton, Danny Glazard. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, where you can get links from this show elsewhere. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. After a summer of bloodshed, intimidation, the arrest of hundreds of leftist activists and journalists, and full-blown military attacks against the Kurdish PKK forces, last weekend, Mr. Recep Erdogan's AKP, Justice and Development Party, reversed its June electoral setback by regaining its majority in Turkey's parliament.
The increase in the AKP votes actually indicates a support for a return to security policies in Kurdish populated cities. So I come to believe that, you know, unfortunately, the rest of this country, Turkey, does not care about Kurds and what happens to Kurds, for that matter, as long as these policies do not hurt them.
This week we'll speak with Istanbul-based political scientist Osman Shaheen about the parliamentary election results in Turkey and what enabled Mr. Erdogan's party, the AKP, to gain a solid majority after last June's parliamentary defeat. This and more coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us. On Sunday, November 1st, President Erdogan's AKP party reversed its recent electoral misfortune by winning the majority it had lost in June's parliamentary election, and came one step closer to his long-held aspiration of imposing his absolute personal rule over Turkey through a constitutional amendment. Shahram Aghamir spoke with Istanbul-based political scientist Osman Shaheen and asked him about how Mr. Erdogan managed to turn his electoral fortunes around.
I will say these general elections were quite significant for a couple of reasons. First, it was the fourth and the last election of consecutive four elections. Since 2014, we held four elections in this country, and this was the last one. The second, remember the Justice and Development Party, the AKP, fared quite bad in general elections only 5 months ago. They garnered around 40.6% of the vote, but they lost the majority in the parliament, and this was for the first time since 2002. This could actually have been a decisive turning point in Turkish politics if the opposition was able to form a coalition. However, the opposition was too divided to do that. And this gave just another opening to the AKP. And President Erdogan, he was able to call for snap elections because especially the leader of National Action Party, a.k.a. MHP, Devlet Bahçeli, he practically did everything he could to bolster the morale of the AKP. And he did that in the name of being, quote-unquote, honest and protecting, you know, again, quote-unquote, the flag and the unity of the country. So if we were to see the results that we have seen in the previous elections, this would actually probably be the end of dominant party politics in Turkey. Again, the dawn of a new era in Turkey. However, the AKP was able to turn this progress backwards. This is very important. And this was mostly due to an incompetent opposition, to a divided opposition. Third, I would say this election was also a kind of referendum of the AKP policies regarding the Kurdish question and its general approach to, you know, this sense of insecurity in Turkey. The fragile peace process, as you very well know, it collapsed on 22nd of July this year because the AKP government simply decided that, you know, it was of no use as a political pool that could actually, you know, gain the AKP more votes in the elections. So there was a return to age-old security policies which put the fight against the PKK before anything else. And the AKP government implemented these policies even though their government was an interim government, which means that, you know, it was actually a temporary government. And between two elections, basically within 5 months, we have seen human rights abuses, losses of civilian lives in the Kurdish populated towns and cities of Turkey. And it seems to me that, and this is my, you know, feeling, that the AKP has won this referendum. In other words, the increase in the AKP votes actually indicates a support for a return to security policies in Kurdish populated cities. So I come to believe that, unfortunately, the rest of this country, Turkey, does not care about Kurds and what happens to Kurds, for that matter, as long as these policies do not hurt them. Fourth, I would say, this election showed that the number one item on the majority of people's agenda is neither, you know, liberties and freedoms, nor economy. When faced with great uncertainties in this country, people, they turn to the only party which had a real chance of forming a single-party government. I think they wanted certainty, and the AKP represented the only viable option to provide that kind of certainty. Other parties, you know, including the mother opposition party, the CHP, Republican People's Party, it was too weak to be that kind of option. So I would say that a huge increase in the AKP votes only within 5 months does not necessarily translate into, you know, a kind of ideological affiliation or affinity with the AKP, nor a 100% support for their policies. It also is an indicator how pragmatic the voters are in my country. I think they thought, let's vote the AKP so that we can have a peace of mind about who governs the country. So in the final analysis, I will say two significant issues were contested in these elections, and these were the possibility of a single-party government and the Kurdish question. Economic success and etc., they were only secondary considerations in these particular elections.
What were the key issues in the campaign run by the governing Justice and Development Party, AKP, and how did it change compared to the June 7th elections?
Well, the AKP did run a campaign on the promise of stability. So they argued that coalitions did not and will not bring about peace, stability and economic growth. They also promoted the view that Turkey, as an island of stability and strong state in a kind of region, the Middle East, where civil war actually ravaged other countries like Syria, like Libya, even in Egypt. So in order for Turkey to continue as a kind of stable political environment in the future as well, they said, we need a single-party government, and it is only the AKP which can give you a single-party government. And they underlined this over and over and over. So just 5 months ago in the previous elections, they built their campaign on the promise of creating a presidential system, which I believe was a major mistake. in a population where only around 35-36% of the people supported.
And explain to us what you mean by the presidential system.
Basically, when we say the idea, or when we talk about the idea of a presidential system, we are referring to something which is way different from what you have in the United States, okay? So the American system, so to say, is based on checks and balances. Well, you have the president, then you have the Congress, and you have a quite strong Supreme Court. We call it the Constitutional Court in Turkey. Erdogan's idea of a president or presidential system, first of all, I doubt, accepts a kind of federalism. Turkey is, it's an extreme example of a unitary state, and I believe Erdogan did not want to change that when he was referring to a presidential system. He also didn't want strong checks and balances. I mean, he openly argued that in public, a strong constitutional court is not a very good idea because constitutional court, it does not represent the national will, whereas Mr. Erdogan, who got 52% of the votes, actually he represents the national will. What he wants basically is a kind of Latin American parent type president who rules the country single-handedly. Well, we have the parliament, but, you know, parliament is just there as a kind of institution. The real power will be in the hands of Mr. Erdogan. This is what the presidential system is in Turkey. Let me give you another example. For instance, there is a two-year lag between the parliamentary elections and the presidential elections back in the United States. Erdogan thinks that, you know, this lag is unnecessary. He wants the parliamentary elections and the presidential elections to be held at the same time so that those parliamentary candidates could also benefit from his popularity. Mm-hmm. So he could also dominate the parliament as well.
He was looking for 2/3 of the parliamentary seats in order to implement his plan for a next strong presidential office, but his party did not achieve that, obviously, on November 1st.
No.
It seems like the November 1st election result was a surprise to almost everyone, including some AKP party officials. Why is that?
Well, it was actually a surprise for everyone, yes, because people were not expecting a significant change in the votes of any party, including the AKP. Well, we have many public opinion research firms, and their polls also suggested that there will be no significant change in the votes of any party. Well, polls actually suggested that it will be a tight race for the AKP. Well, personally, I was expecting a slight decrease in the votes of HDP and MHP, National Action Party, and a slight increase in the votes of AKP and CHP votes. But obviously, it seems that there were some unknown variables. First of all, we did not know the composition of the people who did not go to the ballot box in 7th of June. Now, it seems to me that those people who chose not to vote 5 months ago were predominantly AKP voters, and they didn't go to the ballot box because they actually wanted to punish the AKP for their policies. But they changed their behavior in these elections because now there were too much at stake. Second, we really didn't understand the voter base of Justice and Development Party and Nations Action Party. They are quite similar in many respects. So we always perceive this slight increase in the votes of Nations Action Party for the last 3 or 4 years. But we didn't know, and we couldn't know, that those votes or those people who shifted their allegiance from Nations Action Party to Justice and Development Party would reshift their allegiances or loyalties back to the AKP only in 5 months. And it was a really big shift, which actually caused around 4% decrease in the votes of Nations Action Party.
Looks like the Justice and Development Party, AKP, garnered an additional 4 million votes at the expense of the opposition parties. So you blame the opposition parties mainly for not being able to counter the calls by the ruling Justice and Development Party that calls for stability, to the signals that were sent out. In other words, the opposition could not counter them with something that would be persuasive and convincing to their voters.
Yes, I would say the main victim of this election is National Action Party. It also is the first party to blame for the success of the Justice and Development Party. Put yourself in the shoes of a National Action Party voter. So you vote for this party 5 months ago, and on the day of the elections, the results were declared, and it seems to be a great failure for Justice and Development Party. And your party leader, Devlet Bahçeli, says that no matter what, he's not going to form a government. I mean, how could you vote for a party whose leader doesn't want to be a part of the government? I mean, it's insane. This was a great strategic mistake. They did that, and they were punished for that.
So that was the Nationalist Action Party, known by its acronyms MHP.
MHP.
Yes, that was the right-wing nationalist party. Mm-hmm. What about the leftist People's Democracy Party, HDP, which resembles Syriza in Greece and Podemos in Spain? They enjoyed growing support among the voters in June 1st election. The party had garnered 13.2% of the votes and gained almost 80 seats, but its performance was not as impressive on November 1st. How do you explain that?
So first of all, I don't think Greece, Spain and Turkey are comparable cases. Well, we have three very different cases. I would argue that Turkey is a very big country with a huge economy, with a religiously and ethnically divided society, and its neighbors are Iraq and Syria.
But in terms of its anti-capitalist platform or an environmental platform, does it resemble those parties or not?
When you look at Syriza and Podemos, both of these countries are results of economic crisis. Actually, the worst economic crisis both in Greece and Spain. A similar economic crisis in Turkey in 2001 gave birth to not Syriza or Podemos-like parties, but to the AKP. Even this fact tells me a lot, and it's a vivid reminder of how these countries differ from each other. I would say, rather than comparing these cases with each other, I will remember the fact that Turkey is definitely a Middle Eastern country and should be studied as such.
Fair enough.
I mean, and as we speak, there is a civil war, a low-intensity civil war going on in Kurdish cities. I mean, just today, two Kurds were killed in Kurdish town Silvan. I remember one of the names, who is a 22-year-old, basically teenager. So I would say in this respect, Syriza, Podemos and HDP, they are not operating in the same context. Coming to the success or the failure part, I will say, well, the HDP was definitely expecting to pass the threshold comfortably. And obviously the results proved to be quite stressful for the HDP supporters. This is not a success story, I would say. Its votes are down to 10.7%. And it used to be 13.1%. If we are talking about numbers, around 6 million people voted for HDP 5 months ago. Now this number is also down to 5 million. So the HDP seems to lose around 1 million votes. And the fact that those who shifted their allegiances from the HDP to the AKP in these elections were conservative Kurds is a very, very important factor. I believe the HDP officials, they are studying this fact as we make this conversation with you. Having said that, you know, it is also true that the HDP was not even able to run an election campaign due to government pressure. Their offices and buildings were attacked. Their meetings were bombed. Remember the Ankara massacre? 102 people died. The majority, the great majority of these people were HDP supporters. Even an MP, a candidate, parliament candidate, was killed in this action. And the mainstream media did not give the HDP the opportunity to explain itself at the face of these attacks by the government. Obviously, there was a censorship as well as a smear campaign against the HDP in almost all media outlets. Having said that, I repeat, this should not conceal the fact that the HDP lost around 15% of its support. And therefore, I think the HDP should reconfigure itself as a major actor in a possible peace process. So in 7th of June, people voted HDP because its demand for the peace, or for sustainable peace, was strong. The HDP should re-establish its role as a peace broker between the Turkish state and the PKK. I believe in this context, Selahattin Demirtas has a major role to play. Still, you know, despite all these attacks by pro-government media, by President Erdogan and Prime Minister Davutoğlu himself, he has a reputation beyond his voters, beyond his party. And as long as the HDP does that, it will attract more and more votes from Kurds and Turks alike. HDP is the kind of political project, I think, which will flourish in an environment of peace and stability, because working classes need a voice. Women who are oppressed by the male, they need a voice. I believe the HDP could be that kind of voice. But in all this chaos and blood, all these important things that the HDP could be and could represent simply could not be seen. It's concealed by this environment of insecurity. So the sense of insecurity played into the hands of the governing party rather than the HDP.
Osman, I just want to make sure that it's clear what they said about the HDP, the People's Democratic Party, Democracy Party in Turkey, and how it resembles Syriza in Greece and Podemos in Spain, in its critique of capitalism and its support of environmental issues.
Yes,
and
yes.
As you correctly pointed out, its support of feminism and the rights of gays and lesbians. Would you say that they're similar in that?
Of course, yes. Okay. Of course they are similar, yes.
One of the things about HDP, People's Democracy Party, is its intent to resolve the Kurdish question in Turkey through peaceful means, through its linkage to the issue of justice. While the Kurds comprise more than 20% of the population in Turkey, there is an ongoing military conflict between the Turkish state and the Kurdistan Workers' Party. How did the Kurdish question play out in this election? I know you kind of hinted at that by bringing up the issue of security. How did it actually play out, both in terms of Kurdish and non-Kurdish voters, how they decided to vote?
If you go back to June 7th elections, one of the shocks for the public is the great majority of Kurds now voting for the HDP. This was unexpected, both for the HDP and the AKP. Well, it was mostly due to the votes of the Kurds, both in Kurdish cities but as well as in the West, which kept the AKP as the single party government. In some Kurdish cities, including Diyarbakir, Van, Hakkari, even in Ardahan. Ardahan is quite different from another Kurdish city like Diyarbakir. The HDP was able to prove victorious. But within 5 months, the AKP was able to recover at least some of its losses. So this tells me that, especially among the conservative Kurds, the AKP still has some kind of resonance. It also tells me that despite all these attacks, now a certain part of the Kurdish population in Turkey, they will vote HDP no matter what. Coming back to November 1st elections, the Kurdish question was not only one of the factors, I believe it was the major factor, the decisive factor in these elections. I mean, when you look at the campaign of the Justice and Development Party, AKP, you actually see that. Since 22nd of July, the major target of all AKP officials, it was the HDP. High-level HDP officials, they were attacked. In Kırşehir, a central Anatolian city, a bookstore which was belonging to an HDP official, it was set on fire while this man and his family was still inside and the police was watching. Another 16 stores which belonged to Kurds, some of whom were open supporters of the HDP, their stores were also set on fire, pillaged, and this was done before the eyes of the Turkish police and the Turkish state. So definitely the AKP wanted to create that kind of insecure environment. Definitely the AKP wanted to give the people the impression that there was something going on wrong, and the only party that could solve it, it was the AKP. And the source of all this violence, it was not the state forces per se, but the PKK and the political party which was supported by the PKK, in other words, the HDP. So definitely the Kurdish question, how it was handled, and it was totally, definitely, completely secured approach, which defined the course of events, determined the results of these elections.
And that is Osman Shaheen speaking with Shahram Aramir from Istanbul about last weekend's snap election in Turkey. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You mentioned that the main issue for a lot of voters was stability in the country and bringing a party into power which is able to form a government, and that was AKP. But AKP is also has been described to be leading a hegemonic bloc in Turkey. For several years, it was able to persuade the capitalist class as well as parts of the working class to support its market-oriented project, which was neoliberalism on a steroid.
Yes.
And Mr. Erdogan has even said that the poor, they needed to pull themselves together instead of expecting the government to provide for them. Now, after 13 years of being in power, how did the AKP's economic policies affect the ways the voters and the Turkish people actually feel about AKP and its policies? It's been 13 years, and I know it might not have manifested itself in their votes, but what is your sense of how it has impacted the population?
I would repeat the fact that it was security and the demand for stability which were two determining factors in these elections. When you look at today's Turkey, you will see low economic growth and persistent inflation, devaluation of the Turkish lira, and the inability of the government to create new jobs. This is what we see in Turkish economy for the last, at least for the last 12 months. Honestly, I do not remember the exact figures, but I can say that Turkish economy is growing much slower compared to other so-called emerging markets such as India, China, and even Indonesia. And despite these weakening macroeconomic indicators, more people voted in these elections. So this is something that we need to keep in mind. I remember 2009 municipal elections. In that municipal elections, people punished the AKP for the 2008 economic crisis by slashing its votes 8%. In 2007 general elections, the AKP, you know, got around 46.8% or 46.6%, but it was down to 38.8%. This simply did not happen in 2015. So these elections, it was not about economy or economic growth. Having said that, the AKP was also able to create that kind of impression for the last 13 years, well, for the last 2 years or so, this is how they talk in general public. Well, for the last 2 years or so, we might have made some mistakes, but remember the previous 11 years. We brought modernization to this country. We built new hospitals. We built better schools. Your child, when he's or she is going to the school, she does not pay for her books. We are going to provide you those books. Now you go to the hospital and you are treated like real human beings. If you are poor, we are going to give you, I don't know, some sort of fund, maybe a pension fund. These are all things that the poor sections of this country remember, and I must say, they are afraid of losing recently gained economic rewards. Not in these elections, but I can say that if the AKP represents a viable option that could give them a secure environment, it also represents a viable option that could also provide them those economic rewards or carrots, which it used to provide 2-3 years ago. In this respect as well, the AKP is a much, much better option than the CHP, than the MHP. It has been in power for the last 13 years, and many people, including I, have no such experience with other political parties. So other, most of these parties, CHP, the MHP, the sheer name of these parties also represent economic uncertainty for these people.
So, Osman, the Committee to Protect Journalists has identified Turkey as having the largest number of journalists in prison. The majority of them are Kurdish journalists. 3 days before the general election on November 1st, two newspapers and two television news channels critical of the government were taken over by the government-appointed trustees. And these were presumably affiliated with Mr. Golan, who has fallen out of favor with his former allies, AKP. In response to these actions by the state, a piece in a Hurriyet newspaper read, and I quote this, "This is the Turkey in which we are heading to the polls on November 1st. It's good that we have polls. It gives one a sense of democracy. But other than that, we don't have much left that makes Turkey qualify as quote-unquote democracy." This person goes on to say, "We rather have a lawless, arrogant, aggressive Leviathan, which is grinding its teeth more viciously every passing day." That's from the article. How did the state's restrictions on the Turkish press impact the November 1st election?
Well, the role of the media is pretty much the same in every ideal democracy. It is supposed to be the third eye. It has to criticize the government policies. Well, I would say, for instance, Fox in the U.S. is an exception to the norm. If there is a Republican government, then everything is in heaven. When there is a, you know, democratic government, then everything is hell for Fox. So, in a way, an independent media supposed to be a kind of check mechanism that actually, you know, checks the power of the government. Well, the AKP, however, propagates that every media institution, including, for instance, the Hurriyet newspaper from which you just quoted, as spies. If you dare to criticize the AKP government, you must be a spy. You could be collaborator of a kind of foreign power. It could be Israeli lobby. It could be CIA. It could be MI5, Germany, Lufthansa.
Lufthansa,
yes. So let me tell you the story. So during the Gezi events, pro-government media, AKP officials, they were actually, you know, arguing that
these are the anti-government protests over Gezi.
Back in 2013.
Okay, yes, go ahead. Yes.
In order to kind of encounter these protesters, these people simply argue that now that we are building the biggest airport in Europe, it will damage financial interests of Lufthansa because Frankfurt is no more going to be the most important airport in Europe. It's going to be the third airport that we are having it built in Istanbul. So that's why the German government and Lufthansa are actually behind these protests. So I am not kidding. I am actually quoting these people. Anyway, so we talk about Israeli lobby. We talk about CIA, MI5, Germany, Lufthansa, Iran, Russia, Israel, the Armenian lobby, something called the interest lobby. I don't know how to translate. The United States government, for instance, again, right before the November 1st elections, Erdogan himself, he argued that the HDP, pro-Kurdish party, is working with the same people who were behind the Obama campaign in 2008 elections, if I am not mistaken. In a way, he was implying that the Obama administration is actually backing the HDP.
So there are always these foreign agents and these exogenous forces that
And in other words, the government media, they are like disseminating this view. Let me give you another example. Right after Ankara Başakşehir, Erdogan, he showed his face on one of those government media outlets called A Haber, and he said that behind the Ankara massacre, there are four organizations. The PKK, ISIL.
The Islamic State, yes. The Islamic State.
Yeah, the Islamic State, PYD. The PYD is the political wing of the PKK in Syria. So they are like the political branch of YPG/YPJ. These are two organizations I assume familiar to the American public opinion as well. And Assad.
Bashar Assad in Syria.
Syrian Bashar Assad. The media actually boosts that kind of view. You look at the front pages of government media the next day, it's all over the news.
Hmm.
And you have a public opinion poll which asks which organization, terrorist organization, was behind the Ankara massacre, and you get answers, quite surprisingly, around 10% believes that 10%, which is not a small number, the HDP, a political party, was behind the Ankara massacre. So people actually believe that the HDP killed its own people in its own meeting by planting a bomb. CNN Turk, which is actually Turkish CNN, supposed to be an opposition media, supposedly quite critical of Erdogan and his government, but within 5 months, I have seen so many debates on this TV, on CNN Turk, which was actually talking about the war between the PKK and the Turkish army, which was actually talking about the Kurdish question, and in none of these debates, a single HDP member was invited. Can you believe that? You are talking about Kurdish question, you are talking about the war between the PKK, you are even talking about the HDP, and you are not inviting a member of the HDP. There was an unspoken, a tacit censorship in the last 5 months for every member of the HDP in the mainstream media.
So, Osman, these two questions are sort of related, so I'm going to ask the first one. The result of the June 1st parliamentary elections in Turkey was viewed by some observers as a serious setback for the AKP's Justice and Development Party's hegemonic bloc and its Turkish model of Islamism, which has been described by some, by quite a few analysts, as one that promises, quote-unquote, Islamic liberalism in polity and new liberal capitalism in the economy. Would the November 1st election results change that assessment in terms of erosion of the hegemonic bloc led by AKP? It seems like Turkey is moving into this direction of concentration of power in the hands of one party. And at the same time, the issue of new liberalism, according to some Turkish analysts, is turning to, you know, new liberal capitalism is becoming more of a crony capitalism.
It's no more possible to talk about the hegemonic bloc. There is a marvel. Basically, and the face of this marvel is Erdogan himself. There is no more, I mean, yes, of course, I mean, there is no more liberals. The Gulen Cemaat or the Gulen movement used to be a part of this hegemonic bloc, and it actually was the Gulen organization which provided the hegemonic discourse. So it was due to intellectuals of the Gulen organization that, you know, this hegemonic bloc prevailed over age-old Kemalist institutions such as the army, the judiciary, and the media, and the, you know, old universities. Now it's gone. The friends are not normal friends. Liberals are also expelled from this hegemonic bloc. Prominent journalists such as Hasan Cemal, Cengiz Çandar, now they are not wanted in closed circles. No, they want to have a relationship with Erdogan, so they are also gone. Big business, I assume, and by big business, I mean the Istanbul capital, you know, big conglomerates such as Koç family, Eczacıbaşı, and the Boyners, they are not really on good terms with the AKP government. So in this respect as well, we have to think twice when we utter the word hegemonic bloc. That now there is the leadership of Erdogan, and there's also his hand in the parliament, which is called the AKP. The AKP used to be a coalition of different actors. Now it's a party which is organized and led by Erdogan, and that's it. So this is one thing. In this respect, when you talked about actually crony capitalism, I immediately thought Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. Even the way their families configure in their local politics resemble. So one of the reasons why so many people didn't like Hosni Mubarak was actually his son, Jamal Mubarak, if I am not mistaken. He was representing everything that Egyptians did not have. He was protected by the police. He was able to control the big business. In a way, Bilal Erdogan represents the very similar futures in Turkish politics. Bilal Erdogan is leading this huge organization fund called TÜGEV. Erdogan is giving directions to Minister of Education. So the state, which used to be, again, a kind of sort of impartial polity, which was run with you know, age-old practices, now becoming an organization which is completely loyal to Erdogan, and not only Erdogan, but his family members as well. About this part where you talk about Islamic liberalism, in this respect, I think I already answered the question. I will definitely defend the view that the AKP and its leader Erdogan, they are not proponents of political Islam in Turkey anymore. Islam is just one of the tools that they use to create a discourse, or it's just a political tool which would help them to keep their political hegemony. Well, the neoliberal capitalism part is an integral part of every crony capitalist system. In this respect, it's not surprising. And definitely the November 1st election results did not change the assessment relating to the crony capitalism part and neoliberal capitalism part, but, you know, Islamic liberalism no more, or is, I would say.
So there is a crack in that bloc, definitely, that hegemonic bloc is going through a change, it's becoming weaker. As a final question, let's talk about the outlook for the Turkish society. Istanbul court has ordered the confiscation of the latest issue of Nokta magazine on charges of, and I quote that, overtly inciting people to commit crime and sedition. The magazine showed a picture of Mr. Erdogan on its cover entitled November 2nd, the beginning of the Turkish civil war. And that's the title of the latest edition of Nokta. Do you think that's where Turkey is heading now? That is being ruled by an absolute sovereign and on its path to a civil war?
Well, if he succeeds to be an absolute sovereign, definitely the chances of a civil war will only be slim. So if he cannot or suppress the whole opposition, and if he persists with this war with the PKK, we really don't know what will happen. But this is a very difficult question. This is the Middle East, and everything could change in the Middle East in a matter of days. I mean, one of the reasons why Mubarak was able to hold on to power for so long was actually the American support. For decades, Mubarak argued that, you know, for around 30 years almost, well, if I go, this country will be left to radical Islamists, and then you will have to deal with another unstable country, a huge region in the Middle East. So I represent stability. And look what happened right after Europe was hit with the refugee crisis. Those countries such as Germany, which were quite critical of Mr. Erdogan, they, you know, all of a sudden changed their policies towards Turkey. Merkel, she came to Turkey, and she sat on two quite ugly chairs with Erdogan. I don't know, have you seen those pictures?
I have not had that pleasure, no.
Okay. I see those pair of chairs. Okay, just type Merkel, Erdogan and chairs. You will see what I am talking about. They held a friendly chat about the refugee crisis. So this Syrian civil war definitely represents some limitations, and there is always the danger of spillover of the civil war in Turkish politics as well and into the borders of Turkey, especially if the Turkish government continues its aggressive policies towards Kurdish or Syrian Kurds, I would say. But it also represents an opportunity because Europe sees Turkey as a buffer zone between Syrian refugees and Europe, between the Syrian civil war and Europe. In this respect, they would also see the leadership of a strong man such as Erdogan as a kind of practical tool. So is Turkey heading towards a civil war? I don't know. It's possible. It's possible. It depends on the policies that the Turkish government will follow in coming months. Will they continue their fight with the PKK? And even more important, will they attack YPG and YPJ in Syria? The first, well, I think the state structure and the population in Turkey could handle that kind of pressure, at least to some extent. The second, however, I believe, might cause great havoc. Remember what happened in 2014, in October, when Erdogan said, you know, regarding pertaining to Kobani, the small Kurdish town, he went to, you know, the Syrian border, that he made a speech to Kurdish refugees which just escaped from, you know, Kobani, and Kobani back then was surrounded by Islamic State militants, thugs. And he said that Kobani is about to fall. The next day, the Kurds were all over the streets, and violence continued for 2 days, and more than 50 people died. And it was only with the intervention of Abdullah Öcalan. Abdullah Öcalan simply said that, go back your home, and Kurds return to their homes. We don't know. So these are real possibilities, and this election simply gave a sense of confidence to Mr. Erdogan, and this is very dangerous for a person who is already suffering from overconfidence and arrogance.
Osman Şahin is a political scientist based in Istanbul. He spoke with Shahram Agamir. For updates and more analysis on Turkey, please check jadmagazine.com and vomina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Western port city of Bushehr in Iran has been getting its share of attention in the Western media.
The Bushehr reactor is finally being switched on.
Moscow has been helping Iran build the Bushehr facility since 1995, but work has been delayed several times.
В Новосибирске готова к отправке в Иран первая партия ядерного топлива. В ближайшее время его доставят на атомную станцию в Бушере.
But that is not the attention Bushehr deserves. Perched on the edge of the Persian Gulf, this 2,000-year-old city has been a crossroad for different cultures to blend art, beliefs, food, and dramatically, music. The music of Bushehr is a blend of the traditions of Iranian, Arab, African, and Indian rhythms, resulting in unique and vibrant melodies. The influences of this music can be seen and heard in all aspects of the life in Bushehr, religion, work, and social events. Saeed Shambezadeh, a native of Bushehr, founded Shambezadeh Ensemble at the age of 20. With a sarong wrapped around his waist and holding a lambskin Iranian bagpipe, Saeed dances bare-chested to a rhythm accompanied by the percussion section of Shambezadeh Ensemble. Even though Saeed Shambezadeh has been collaborating with modern dance companies, but first and foremost, on this stage, he tries to introduce audiences around the world to unique melodies and sounds of his hometown, Bushehr. Saeed Shambezadeh has also done extensive research on the music of southern Iran, which has historically been preserved by oral traditions.
The music for one ceremony. We don't call it music. We don't say it dance. For example, seamen, they are singing the work song in the sea. They are seamen. They are not musicians. When one person singing in the religious ceremony, he is a singer of the religious ceremony. When one person play drum in the religion ceremony, he playing the dammam in the ceremony. And one person singing and dancing in the zar ceremony, we don't call it music. But when we say music, most of the people in Iran, in south, in north, in east, west, immediately they are thinking about the music, what we play in the wedding. They call it music. In south of Iran, in all the ceremony, we have music and dance. When I found this group, I said to myself, you know, the music is not only what we play in the wedding ceremony. And I use all these repertoires, all these songs, I brought it on the stage.
Music is amalgam of Arabic, African, Indian, Persian. Where do these influences come from?
In South Iran, all the people, they was living together. They didn't have the class of the, in the society, like black or white. This is the culture of South Iran. People, they married, it was their life. And also that we should know that the nature of this part of Iran, it's hot. Weather, there is a sea, we have the very energetic music, and it is not only because it is coming from Africa, but we have an African root.
You trace your own ancestry to Zanzibar in East Africa.
In the 17th century, that's when they bringing the black as a worker, not a slave, because the people, they was Muslim. The black never was a slave in Iran. They came from Zanzibar, they worked, like my mother's side. The father of my mother, his root was African. My father's side, no. My father's side, it is Iranian and Balochistan and Arab mixed together. Like my face, you know, I don't have the African nose. I don't have what I have dark skin, and we don't have this word Afro, but there is African root, Indian, Arab, and Iranian, and from, for example, Loristan, Lori, in our accent, when we speak, we have many words from Lori language or Lori accent. It was the crossroad.
Yes, it was a port city, and it was
Jewish,
populated by various cultures.
Yes, Christian, Muslim, or Ashuri from Mesopotamia.
Yeah, from Assyrians.
Know. Yeah, and so many people in South Iran, they was living together there.
So all of these different cultures are reflected in your music.
Exactly.
You founded your group in 1990, and you have been out of Iran for 10 years.
Yeah.
During the time that you were in Iran, how successful were you in introducing this music to other parts of Iran?
The only thing that I had, I was sure about my culture, and I knew that my musical culture, it's not smaller than the other cultural music, like Iranian classic music or Western classic music. If you play piano, and you play very, very bad piano, and if there was another person play surna, one simple oboe is the mother of oboe, one of the first Iranian instruments. It is the nai of the happiness, surnai, and he is a master. If you play piano or you play flute traversier, like Western classic flute, and another person play surna, and this flute player, he play very bad, and he doesn't know classic music, but in the society, in Iranian society, it has more class because he play Western instrument. If you play tar or sitar or Iranian classic music, and another person from Khorasan, he play dotar, the tar player, he has more, because the tar, it is the instrument that they presented in the big cities. If one person play kopuz from Azerbaijan, he cannot have the same place as one tar player in Tehran, even he will be master.
So
it is the first problem of the Iranian musician from different parts of Iran. And I challenged, because I was sure about what I am doing. It was the big problem, and it is a big problem for many artists that live, for example, in Balochistan, in Azerbaijan, in Kurdistan, in Mazandaran, in Gilan.
Talk a little bit about instruments used in the southern parts of Iran.
First of all, why we say Bushehri music or Baluchi music or Kurdish music? We have the rhythm and the scales. For example, in Bushehri music, we use the special scales. This is the important part. And after that, we use the instrument. It is helping the bass of the melody. Like, for example, in Iranian classic music, they have the special scales, special ornamentation. And in Bushehri music, we have our ornamentation. The instrument that we use also, it's helping us to be close to what we want to do. For example, ne and ban, it is one kind
which
of
is the bagpipe,
but it's very different of the Western bagpipe. Or ne jofti, or
Ney Jofti is the double flute.
Ney Muru or flute, traditional, or zarb, tempo, dammam.
Dammam is a two-sided
percussion.
Yeah.
You can play also Bushehri music with the other instrument, but the Bushehri music has
its own characteristic.
Characteristic, scale, intervals, rhythm.
Hele hele wa yamar. هله هله و یامال هله مردا به نازام هله مردای جنگی هله و یامال هله هله و یامال هله و یامال هله و یامال هله هله و یامال هله و یامال هله هله و یامال هله
that you play, or the music of Bushehr, reflects the daily lives of people.
You know, all of the music, all the root of all the different kind of music that exists in the world, it was like this.
Mm-hmm.
I traveled a lot in all the village that we had in the Bushehr province, and also I was working in the religion ceremony in the... I grew up in this, but when I was 17 or 20 years old, I said to myself, I should play it on a stage, to how I can use what I know. And I try to going back to all the ceremonies and listening more and pay attention to the ceremonies. For example, we have a main singer, but there is many things around this, and I pay attention to all of this, and I try to bring all these elements and use all of them on a stage. It's not finished, it's not done yet. We just started.
Saida Shambazadeh is the founder of Shambazadeh Ensemble, an Iranian folk band from southern Iran.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. War, Peace and Climate Change, Professor Michael Clare. This is the record of a meeting of the minds between an organization, Peace Action, that has worked for over 50 years on the abolition of nuclear weapons and war, and an activist professor. Michael Clare has written and taught on U.S. military policy, international peace and security affairs, the global arms trade, and global resource politics. The question on everybody's mind that night was, how are war and climate change related, and how can we find ways of addressing that dual danger by working on strategies of resolving both? Here's Professor Michael Clare. He spoke at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action on October 24, 2015. That was on the eve of the International Conference COP21 in Paris. Thank you.
So hello, everyone. I'm very thrilled to be here with you tonight. I want to honor you as longtime peace activists. I'm a longtime peace activist myself. I think I went to my first peace rally in 1960 or 61 as a college student in New York City at a Ban the Bomb demonstration when we were supposed to go underground. You remember those days? And active protest people refused to go underground. And that was the beginning of my activism for peace, and I've been involved in the peace movement ever since. So I congratulate all of you for your good work. And I especially want to congratulate you for linking all these issues, especially the issue of peace and climate change, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight. These are the two most pressing issues of our time, and as I will argue, they are intricately linked. The more we can highlight these, the linkages, I believe, the better our chances of achieving progress on both. That's what I want to try to demonstrate tonight. Now, I think you all know that government officials from all over the world will be converging in Paris beginning on November 30th for a pivotal conference on climate change, probably the most important, most pivotal conference ever held on the environment. Officially, this is called the 21st Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP21. And you're going to be hearing a lot about this in the weeks to come. Now, this conference is being billed as a climate or an environmental conference, a meeting intended to address climate risks. But I hope to demonstrate tonight that it is also a peace conference, perhaps one of the most important peace conferences in human history. If it succeeds, we could avoid a global epidemic of resource wars. If it fails, the world will get hotter, both in climate terms and in military terms. Now, as you probably know, the stated goals of COP21 is to adopt a series of measures, country by country, that will prevent global greenhouse gas emissions from reaching a level that would cause the Earth to warm no more than 2 degrees centigrade on average. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the maximum amount that scientists agree the Earth can absorb without triggering cataclysmic climate effects, such as the melting of the Greenland and Antarctica ice sheets, which, if they do melt, will cause a sea level rise of 10 to 20 meters, potentially wiping out cities like New York and Washington and Philadelphia, Baltimore, Miami, and many other cities around the world. Now, before I go any further with this, let me point out that many scientists, including James Hansen of Columbia University, believe that a temperature increase of even 1 degree centigrade, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit average increase, will result in cataclysmic climate events. And in fact, we're very close to that already. The Earth has warmed approximately 0.8 degrees centigrade since the beginning of the Industrial Age, and we're already beginning to see early warning signs of catastrophic tipping points. I wrote about that recently in an article for TomDispatch.com, and I researched this and events that scientists thought might happen after 2050 or at the end of the century are beginning to happen now. By tipping points, I mean not a linear increase in temperature and the like, something that we could adjust to gradually, but sudden breaks in the routine, dramatic, irreversible events that have cascading effects that would be devastating for humans and all other creatures on the planet, such as the slowing of the Gulf Stream, which would cause, as you can imagine, vast weather changes in North America, Eastern North America, and Europe, and so forth. The melting of the Arctic ice cap, which would remove a reflecting lens that of white that sends heat back into the atmosphere. If that melts, the Earth will absorb much more solar radiation, accelerating the pace of climate change. We're beginning to see the melting of permafrost in the far north, and that contains a lot of methane, so that would be released into the atmosphere, speeding up the pace of climate change. And we're seeing the dying out of the Amazon, something that nobody thought was possible. And that, too, would have follow-on effects around, certainly in Latin America, with the drought that's hit a lot of Brazil. So these effects are already in evidence, and that's with a temperature increase of only 0.8 degrees centigrade. It's already probably too late to stop some of these calamities from occurring, but it's not too late to stop warming from reaching beyond 2 degrees centigrade. And once that barrier is crossed, it will become almost impossible to prevent these catastrophic events and far greater calamities from occurring. Hence, it is absolutely essential that delegates at the Paris Climate Summit succeed in adopting measures that will continue global warming to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius. And we could talk afterwards about what's likely to happen there. If they fail to do so, and there's no guarantee of success, we're not likely to have another opportunity like this anytime soon. This would mean, in all likelihood, that we'll continue to pour out greenhouse gases at an ever-increasing rate, as we have been doing for the past decades, and the planet will shoot well beyond 2 degrees centigrade increase to 3 degrees, 4 degrees, or even more. And scientists tell us that the effects of this will be absolutely cataclysmic. It's painful to even imagine what that would mean, what a world like that would mean, especially if you have children or grandchildren, as I know many of you do, or if you work with children or young people in some capacity, like teaching or as caregivers. I'm teaching a class now at Hampshire College, where I work, on climate change effects to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And it horrifies me to talk with them about the literature that we're reading. We're reading the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC reports, on these kind of predictions of what we could expect in the second half of the century, when they will be mature adults and maybe having children of their own. These projections indicate that many areas of the United States will be suffering from perpetual drought and wildfires like those we saw this summer in California and the Pacific Northwest, and from recurring storms and flooding like that we saw with Hurricane Sandy and now Hurricane Patricia that hit yesterday and the west coast of Mexico. But I want to say that they, that is to say my American students, are going to be privileged compared to others on the planet in 2050 in all likelihood in this regard. I shudder to think about the future that my students from Africa and the Middle East and Asia will face in the decades ahead. According to the IPCC, these areas will face extreme water scarcity, recurring crop failures, habitat collapse, and even higher temperatures than we will face in North America, leading to state collapse, starvation, and mass migrations. So the conference in Paris is absolutely pivotal in determining if we will be able to keep global warming at a level that most humans can survive, or if it will move into the realm where the survival of many populations and societies can no longer be taken for granted. And this is why I say that the Paris Climate Summit is not just an environmental conference, but also a peace conference. Because a failure in Paris would mean not only environmental catastrophe, but also chaos, instability, desperation, and war. On the other hand, success in Paris could lay the groundwork for progress in achieving greater world peace. Let me explain all this a bit further. If you read the most recent report of the IPCC, specifically the report of Working Group 2, there are three working groups, one on the science of climate change, one on mitigation, that is what we have to do to prevent things from getting beyond 2 degrees, and one on impacts, vulnerabilities, and adaptation. That's working group two. That looks at what this will mean to human civilizations. And if you read that report, you will find that the likely impacts of climate change include not just floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires and coastal flooding, but also wars, riots, and battles over vital resources. The reason for this is threefold. First, I don't think I have to tell you. The world is already bitterly divided along lines of race, class, ethnicity, religion, language, and caste. Wherever you look, societies are being riven by antagonisms between people of different groups, however defined, whether they be Shiites and Sunnis, Arabs and Jews, Hindus and Muslims, Catholics and Protestants, and so on. You just have to pick up the daily newspaper, something I force myself to do every day, and if you dare, to see that this is so. There are many reasons for this, of course, including the legacies of colonialism, failed post-colonial states, global economic inequity, mass youth unemployment, and so on. These problems have been growing more intense in recent years and only seem to be growing stronger with the years. Secondly, many of these schisms would be there even without climate change. Second, many of these schisms coincide with differences in access to the vital necessities of life: food, water, land, housing, health care, etc., with some groups enjoying greater access to the vital necessities and other groups enjoying access to less. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, for example, which has been heating up in recent weeks, as you know, is driven by deep-seated religious and ethnic hostilities. But it is also driven by fights over land and water, with the Palestinians experiencing far more deprivation in this regard than the Israelis. The same is true of many of the other disputes we see in the world today. In Iraq, the Sunnis enjoyed privileged positions under Saddam Hussein, and now under the Shiite leadership are being denied access to vital resources. And so it's no wonder that many of them have joined with ISIS. You see this in all of the conflicts we're seeing around the world, that the divides along racial and ethnic lines also coincide with differentiated access to the vital necessities of life. And needless to say, the struggle for vital resources and a perception that one's rivals or oppressors are enjoying better access to these vital resources adds enormous fuel to these already existing antagonisms, increasing the risk of armed violence. And then third, add in the third factor to this, climate change will accentuate these resource differentials, imposing greater pain and hardship on some communities than on others. Now, greater harm falling typically on those that are already suffering the most. And this, in turn, will increase the sense of deprivation and desperation among those most affected. Groups that already suffer from inadequate access to food, water, and shelter will find their access even further curtailed, increasing their fury. Now, let me be clear about this. Everybody will suffer from climate change, especially if warming exceeds 2 degrees centigrade. But these hardships will not be distributed evenly. Some people will suffer more than others. And when the divide between those who suffer more and those who suffer less coincides with existing racial, ethnic, and religious schisms, the likelihood of violent conflict goes way up. to fully appreciate this, you have to understand that climate change is essentially a resource catastrophe. Yes, I know it's going to damage the environment and threaten all kinds of species that have been on the planet for a very long time, but from a human perspective, what climate change is going to do is to degrade and destroy the vital resources on which we all depend, especially land, food, and water. These will become more scarce and more degraded as climate change proceeds. Think of Kenya, Nigeria, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Nigeria, where various tribes and communities have long been fighting over control of the best watered, most fertile land. Typically, the most powerful and politically connected tribes and groups have occupied the most desirable land, forcing less powerful and less well-connected groups to survive in less desirable, less watered lands. As the planet warms, climate change will pose a threat to all farmlands in Africa and elsewhere, but those already water scarce will become water deprived, making human survival nearly impossible in many areas. Those occupying these now parched landscapes will be forced to abandon their homeland, either to invade and conquer less impacted neighboring lands, or to move to cities in other countries where they are sure to face hostility and violence from those already residing there. This is already occurring across a broad swath of sub-Saharan Africa known as the Sahel, the southern fringe of the Saharan Desert, where spreading desertification is forcing Muslim herders to migrate south into farmlands occupied by Christians and animists, producing wars in half a dozen countries, including Mali, Niger, Sudan, Nigeria, and Somalia. The same pattern is being seen in North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Now, typically, these wars are described in the media as ethnic and religious wars because the parties to conflict are organized by tribe and religion and are rallying around the sectarian appeals of their demagogic leaders. At heart, however, these are climate wars because the fuel for combat is competition over the vital resources made scarce by climate change. As the planet warms and more resources become scarce and degraded, the risk of resource-driven conflict is bound to increase, sweeping from Africa and the Middle East to the rest of the planet. And so this is why I say the Paris Climate Conference is also a peace conference. If we could limit the increase in global temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade or hopefully less, we vastly diminish the risk that the world will plunge into an endless nightmare of climate-driven resource wars. In sum, every fraction of a degree less temperature increase we succeed in achieving is a critical step towards reducing the risk of global bloodshed. That is why I view the Paris Climate Summit as a peace conference. But there is another reason why we could view this conference as a peace conference. That's because it will only succeed if every nation on Earth, and especially the major industrial powers, the United States, China, Russia, the European Union countries, Japan, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and so on, agree on a common framework for reducing the emission of greenhouse gases, and on ensuring the full implementation of promises made in Paris. Every country has to agree to do their part to keep temperatures below 2 degrees. This means that countries that are not especially friendly to each other, the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and China, India and China, and so on, must cooperate with one another in reaching a successful conclusion. If they allow their current disagreements, and there are plenty of those, to intrude into the proceedings, the conference will fail, and we will all be condemned to a climate-altered world. They must cooperate for our mutual well-being. And bear in mind, we're talking about measures that will impose significant restrictions on the energy systems and economic behavior of all these countries, something never before attempted in human history. All the countries who agree to this, if they do, are going to have to alter how they produce energy and how their economies are going to be run. That means the U.S. and China and Russia all have to cooperate in this endeavor. For this to work, all of the countries will need to continue working together year after year in a cooperative manner in order to ensure that the adopted measures are fully carried out. This means that whatever their attitudes towards one another, they must collaborate on very critical matters with continuous follow-up sessions, procedures, meetings, and so on. If the process works well, we could see a new era of international cooperation. If it breaks down, not only will we experience a more climate-destroyed planet, but a world of increased international tension and hostility. In this sense, collaboration in slowing climate change may prove to be the best opportunity we will ever have to ensure international cooperation and peace. In fact, if it succeeds, the Paris climate could prove to be as momentous as the San Francisco Peace Conference of 1945, which established the United Nations. That's what's at stake in this meeting. It is essential, then, that we do everything we can to make it succeed. And not only that, even if it succeeds, there will be many in this country and others in other countries who will work to sabotage the agreements, either for ideological reasons or because they have a vested interest in perpetuating the fossil fuel industries responsible for climate change. All the Republican candidates for president, so far as I could see, fall into this category. Accordingly, we will have a long march ahead of us. We have a lot of work to do to resist efforts to undermine any progress achieved in Paris and to ensure the full implementation of its accords. But to conclude, I believe that such efforts will represent a worthy continuation of all the work you and our allies have done all these years in the pursuit of international peace and cooperation. This could prove to be one of the most momentous, important events in human history. So we have hope as well as dread as we look into the future. And I'll end with that thought. So thank you very much.
That was Professor Michael Clare. He's Fife College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and a prolific author. The titles of just the last three of his books clearly delineate his expertise and purpose. They are Resource Wars, 2001, Blood and Oil, 2004, and The Race for What's Left, 2015. Michael Clare was recorded by Dale Lehman on October 24, 2015, at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action. Peace Action formed through the merger of SANE, the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, and the FREEZE, the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. Professor Clare mentioned the December 2015 COP21, the UN Conference of Parties in Paris, and its significance as the biggest and last opportunity to address climate change at an international conference. Even if you hear this talk after that meeting, the work for everybody will have just begun. If the meeting succeeded in setting limits on fossil fuel emissions, They need to be enforced. If the meeting failed, the solution will lie in the hands of civil society, the grassroots, everybody, all of us. Come back when TUC Radio returns for a lively exchange of questions and answers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
There is a dance danced by the political animals we call human beings. When we dance around the truth, it is called the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. And the more political you are, the more ornate and baroque your moves. We dance around the truth when the truth is not convenient for us. For nearly 70 years, some of the most impressive and dazzling moves have been danced when people are dancing the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot over the issue of Israel and Palestine. And now my own country of Aotearoa is busting a move, dancing the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot in no less a venue than New York at the UN Security Council itself. But to understand this, perhaps it's worth considering a little background on this country.
Aotearoa, better known by its slave name of New Zealand, because European explorers, on seeing a country full of glaciers and rainforests and snow-capped mountain and ranges and so forth, could be easily forgiven for wanting to name it after a small flat piece of land in the Netherlands. Anyway, Aotearoa feels itself to be a plucky little country that punches above its weight.
This is the source of our sense of exceptionalism, and
a lot of people would think, well, exceptionalism is what happened in the USA, but any country that defines itself by its own mythology is prone to exceptionalism. Exceptionalism is simply the tendency to see what you do as defined by who you think yourself as being, rather than to examine what you do and judge it the way you would judge it if anyone else did it. For Aotearoa, our own self-image says that we are exceptionally nice people, more civilized than anyone else apart from possibly the Scandinavians, and maybe in some context the Swiss or something like that. We see ourselves as inherently fair, and we believe that we command respect from other people beyond what you would normally expect for a country of our size. This notion has been fed over time by the British particularly, who found it was an exceptionally good idea to patronize New Zealanders in order to use them as cannon fodder. And I'm not joking about that. We have been used quite severely as cannon fodder. During World War I, 10% of the country was sent overseas. And of them, I think roughly 40% didn't come back. So we sent 10% of our entire population overseas and lost 4% of our population because the British ordered us to. We didn't get to vote on whether to declare war or anything like that. We were simply told, you're at war now, and we did our bit. Our actions after that, of course, bring into question the very notion that we're the nice people we say we are, because we promptly invaded Turkey and started killing young Turkish soldiers without any real justification. Now, the Turks have been very nice to us about this ever since, but if you think about it, I don't think it would be true. We would reciprocate if Turkey had invaded us in the same manner. In many ways, our role as a cat's paw of imperial powers hasn't changed that much. It's true that we do clearing mines and peacekeeping and so forth, but even those operations are often politically useful for imperial powers, and we are adding our flag to coalition forces that often are committing acts of aggression. We, of course, were part of the aggression against Vietnam, and we have never apologized to anyone for that. In fact, you know, like we take our cue from the US in these things, we tend to think of ourselves as the victims of, well, in Gallipoli, the victims of our British masters, but in Vietnam, victims of whatever. It's like we don't even understand what we're the victims of. We're just victims. Anyway, the fact is that these larger powers feed our inflated sense of self-importance in order to use us.
And where we used to provide excellent cannon fodder, we now seem to provide excellent stuffed shirts and self-important people. My favorite example of this would be Jeffrey Palmer, who is an incredibly nice guy. We know he's an incredibly nice guy because he's written two memoirs pointing out that he is an incredibly nice guy. And he was the chair of the committee that produced the Palmer Report. He was on the committee with Alvaro Uribe, the Colombian war criminal or mass murderer. And they produced this report that said that Israel was perfectly entitled to attack the Mavi Marmara because they refused to look into the legality of the blockade, and therefore they assumed that the blockade was legal, and therefore actions taken to enforce the blockade were legal. It's a kind of, well, you have to be quite an idiot to come up with that sort of logic, but, you know, they did. And as I said, Jeffrey Palmer, highly respected constitutional lawyer and all-round nice guy, did his wonderful job sitting next to his good friend, the mass murderer from Colombia. So that pretty much gives you an idea of our track record. And plucky little New Zealand, again, the mouse that roared, has spent loads of taxpayers' money in getting itself a seat on the United Nations Security Council, something which a few countries of our size have done, but we have repeatedly. And our great project in this has been a determination to decide to bring peace to the Middle East. Now, when I say peace to the Middle East, it seems that that we focused more on Israel-Palestine than other parts of the Middle East, like Syria. And apparently, a few days ago, New Zealand's UN Security Council delegations circulated a draft resolution about 2 pages long, proposing a path towards a two-state solution. This is what Dr. Vasi Vlasna had to say about it. New Zealand, like all Western governments, obsequiously replicated Zionist propaganda in the resolution. New Zealand normalizes Israeli atrocities by falsely presenting Israel and Palestine as equal perpetrators and equal victims, and by pushing the demand that Palestine gives up its endeavor for justice in the International Criminal Court, thus letting Israel off scot-free for monstrous war crimes and crimes against humanity, while New Zealand demands that Israel freezes its rapacious settlements in which New Zealand invests, it absurdly promotes the farce of negotiations that expand settlements, and then it obediently keeps up the pretense of a two-state solution when Netanyahu has repeatedly ruled out Palestinian sovereignty. New Zealand does not act on its recommendations and will not make a move first to recognize the Palestinian state, and loading, this is quoting here, loading more inanity on the ridiculous, New Zealand calls on the same incompetent clowns, the quartet, US, Russia, United Nations and the European Union, Security Council and Arabs, to maintain the posturing of the nihilistic negotiations. My apologies to Dr. Vlasna there for slightly mangling her words, but I think you get the picture. Well, the thing is this. What they're doing is using the camouflage of the rather irrational pretenses we all have about the Israel-Palestine situation and normalizing some rather bizarre pretenses we have that avoid the truth, and hence why I call it the whiskey tango foxtrot. So what I think we should do is actually go back through some basic stuff about Israel-Palestine and where does justice lie, and why does Aotearoa have a particular legal and moral obligation to go much further and be much more honest than this resolution is. So, to begin with, well, Jewish migration to Palestine from Europe began before World War I. These waves of Jewish migration are called Aliyah, or rather Aliyot, which is the plural, it immediately started problems because a lot of the landowners were absentee landlords living in the more cosmopolitan areas of the Ottoman Empire, and their tenants were often had generations of tenure there, so they were often rather surprised to find that some European Zionists had gone behind their back, this began in the late 19th century, to their absentee landlords and bought the land from under them. This started really fermenting ill feeling. Now, then exactly 98 years ago, the day before yesterday, the British came up with what's called the Balfour Declaration. Now, the Balfour Declaration was virtually a nothing. It says only the following. His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So this is a pretty minimal statement from a power that wasn't, in fact, didn't have political control over Palestine or anything at the time. And the reason we have all heard of it, or a lot of people have heard of it, is that Zionists have used it as a source of legitimacy. Of course, it's nothing of the sort. What Britain declared in 1917 or didn't is really not relevant to the justice of the issue. And I find it interesting that anti-Zionists often talk about the Balfour Declaration as being significant. It really isn't significant at all. But it was just its 98th anniversary, so I brought it up anyway. Then at the end of World War I, Britain took on a mandate over Palestine, meaning that it assumed control of Palestine under an agreement that basically said that it was temporarily taking over for the benefit of the people who couldn't govern themselves, of course. Now, the main thing you have to realize in trying to assess what the British were doing in encouraging Zionism in Palestine is that different people had different views, all right, and different motivations. Now, some British people, including people in the halls of power, were opposed to Zionism. What I think is key, though, for people to remember is that a very significant faction, a group that was in a position to exert power over what was happening, saw Israel as a way of setting up an enclave of European people who were antagonistic to the local Arab people. Now, Britain had really adopted oil as its fundamental strategic commodity. You know, it had converted from coal to oil after first being pressed to do this by a guy called Admiral Fisher. He started in 1895, and it took them a long time to be convinced to switch from coal, which they had in plentiful supply, to oil. But what they did once they did was they went out to try and control as much of it as they possibly could. One quarter of British Empire troops were directed into the Middle East during World War One, while by far the most intense fighting was happening on the Western Front. So this was pretty much how they gained control of most Middle Eastern oil, and Israel obviously was going to play a big part in keeping control of that in future years. Now, once they had a mandate over Palestine, which of course gave them an obligation to the Palestinian people, and there was the League of Nations Charter and all this sort of thing, so they had legal niceties to observe. But they still wanted to set up this Jewish homeland, and they produced a white paper. And the white paper said, no, you can't do that. That's silly. How could you possibly set up a Jewish homeland in the land of a people who are already there? Well, obviously, this annoyed some people. So they produced another white paper, which said pretty much exactly the opposite. It glossed over all of the moral and legal difficulties with that sort of thing. And then finally they produced a third white paper, which more or less reiterated what the first one had said. It said, you can't do this. It's just not acceptable. Right. Well, in the meantime, of course, then came World War II and the Holocaust. And then after the war, there was still a faction thinking exactly the same way. And I have to say as well that during the mandate period, the British struggled with insurgency from the Palestinians and with Jewish terrorism. And in some ways, I have to say there was a general tendency to not come down as hard as they might have on Jewish terrorists when Jewish terrorists did things like blow up British citizens, for example. Whereas in the Palestinian Revolt, sometimes referred to as the Great Revolt, there was a lot of violence against Jewish settlers, but largely the Palestinian Revolt was mainly Palestinians attacking the British authorities, and most of the violence, in fact, was inflicted by the British on the Palestinians. So in a sense, the British were predisposing the political forces, in a way, for what was to come by repressing one more than the other. So the British could not justify handing over Mandate Palestine to the Zionists. And what they did instead was to basically let things become unstable and then throw it into the hands of the UN. Now, the UN came up with a partition plan. This, you know, this was like during there was a sense of crisis, and the UN came up with a partition plan. This partition plan would give 51% of Mandate Palestine to the Zionists and 49% to the Palestinians. Now, the problem in a way for the Zionists would be that the 51% they were promised would actually have a majority Palestinian population. There was absolutely no way of dividing up the map where you'd get a significant proportion with a Jewish majority. There just wasn't much, there were no Jewish majority areas. So, in fact, the Zionist forces, which would later coalesce into the IDF, began planning ethnic cleansing from the beginning. Now, the partition plan, the British abstained from the partition plan, but strong-armed other countries, including Aotearoa, into voting for it. Right? Now, the UN, therefore, the UN General Assembly, therefore, had imposed upon the Palestinian people a partition of their country, which which was, this was before the, admittedly, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Convention on the Refugee Convention. However, the fact is that they were pretty much breaking their own principles under the United Nations Convention by doing so. Now, predictably, the Palestinians and the neighboring Arab countries rejected the UN partition plan. There is really no particular reason why they would have accepted it, of course, except for one, which was that the predominant military power in Mandate Palestine, or in the Palestine area, was the soon-to-be IDF, the Jewish militias, which would go on to form the IDF, which were, of course, the formed, which were the very same terrorist groups that were bombing and carrying out terror attacks under the British rule, of course. Now, it were contrary to myth, it took the neighbouring Arab countries some time to militarily mobilise to oppose what the IDF was doing. And the Zionists, we now know, and Arab historians have claimed this for a long time, but everyone always said they were just biased. But we now know for sure that the Zionists had a plan for ethnic cleansing to be undertaken by massacring civilians, then driving them out. And the Israelis would later claim that the Arabs, foreign Arabs, had told them to leave and stuff like that. It's just not true. So they seized 82% of Mandate Palestine, and the rest was the Gaza Strip, which ended up in Egyptian hands, and the West Bank, which ended up in Jordanian hands. Jordan hadn't exactly played an honourable role in the war against the new Israeli forces, I have to say. But the Egyptians sacrificed many, many, many people. They lost a lot of soldiers fighting against Israel then. Anyway, these would later become, of course, the Palestinian occupied territories. But the point is that the United Nations had created this situation, and they passed a resolution soon afterwards committing themselves to finding a just and lasting peace. Now, number one, can a just and lasting peace come out of a two-state solution which would provide 18% of Mandate Palestine to the Palestinians? I would say that's not true. Number two, can a just and lasting solution come out of any agreement that does not allow all those refugees who were ethnically cleansed from Palestine to return to Israel and have full political rights? No, it cannot. Those people who are often living as refugees in neighbouring countries have now sometimes been made refugees again, such as the ones in Syria. And then many of them live in refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza. And you can imagine, I think we all know now, what's been going on in Gaza. This tiny piece of land with an incredible population density of people who have no means of being economically self-sufficient, whose very lives are controlled by people who are exceptionally hostile to them, who attack them militarily with some of the most powerful military weapons on a regular basis, and frequently refer to it as mowing the lawn. So, just and lasting peace. Does it sound like the INFAT resolution, the draft resolution put forward by the New Zealand delegation to the UN Security Council, is anything like a just and lasting peace? I really doubt it. It is embedding the lies that have been, well, the lies that have become an edifice of official truth in the halls of power. But the real truth doesn't go away. The real refugees don't disappear. Now, the refugees from Palestine are not under the United Nations High Council on Refugees, which was created with the UN Refugee Convention, which came a little over a year after this. However, that convention gives them inalienable rights to return. That means that no one can negotiate it away. The Palestinian Authority can't negotiate away those rights. No one can. So, again, just and lasting peace cannot happen without that happening. And those of us who follow these things, we know there is no two-state solution. It's just beyond a joke now. I mean, it's almost like admitting defeat in some ways that Palestinians cannot have self-determination in their own state, but they will be a lot better off if they can achieve political rights in a unified state than they are now under the pretense that there is some sort of two-state solution, because such a thing doesn't exist. So what is our role as Aotearoa in this? We're perpetuating the lie. We're dancing around the truth. And I said it was the whiskey tango foxtrot, my little joke there, but it's also maybe just a little bit of the lickspittle limbo, seeing how low we can go. Anyway, I think I've said enough. Thank you for listening. And, well, next time my country does something that makes me deeply ashamed, I'll probably record another one of these, and maybe you can listen to that too. My name is Kieran Kelly, and you have been listening to me angrily ranting about stuff. Thank you, and goodbye.